This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This is It Was a Thing on TV.
Spoiler number one is Dr. Lee Franz. It stinks.
What is going on? What is going on?
Hello, Place to Be Nation. This is Greg back with you with another trio of episodes from TV Obscurica. Today, we're going to be looking at the 1978 CBS hour-long comedy Flying High, followed by our special set of two episodes we had last Christmas. First, we have the Star Wars Holiday Special as we travel to Kashyyyk to meet Chewie and his family of Wookiees, take on the Empire. And then we have a very special, I would say, hour and 40-minute look at the TV Food Network series Mystery Diners. And you might be thinking, well, that's not a fun episode, but trust me, guys, it's going to be very fun. And I swear to God, you're going to be addicted to the show by the end of the episode. But anyways, let's get into Past Me along with Mike and Chico as we look at Flying High.
Welcome to the It Was a Thing on TV podcast, episode 15, submission 527, Flying High. Flying High aired on CBS from August 28th of 1978 to January 23rd of 1979, for a total of 18 episodes, three of which were unaired. Welcome back. Mike is here again. And as always, I have Chico and Greg. And we're sort of continuing what we talked about earlier in the week with Supertrain. We talked about Supertrain, which is obviously a train. We had the Love Boat, which is a boat. Now we're going to go airborne. Flying High was kind of sort of an equivalent, albeit not necessarily an equivalent, to those two shows. And took place in the air. So the main theme of the show was it followed three stewardesses, and they were played by Connie Selica, a young Connie Selica at that.
Yeah, and Connie Selica was 23 on this series.
Yeah, she was almost a kid at that point. Pat Klaus, no relation, and Catherine Witt. And the captain of the plane was Howard Platt, who played Hoppy, Officer Hopkins, on Sanford and Son previously. And he was the partner of, if you don't remember, Smitty, who was played by Hal Williams, who later went on to be Marla Gibbs' husband on 227. And something very interesting about this.
Ooh, I like interesting.
Well, it could be scandalous if you think about it in some ways, but Howard Platt, when he was on the show, he was dating or had a romantic relationship with Connie Selica. The big thing is, as Greg said, Connie Selica was 23 and Howard Platt was 40.
Mm-hmm.
Well, somebody either likes him really young or somebody likes him really old. But yeah, they had a little relationship, which led to an engagement. They never got married, but it did lead to an engagement at some point. And also, Tanya Roberts was supposed to be in the cast, but was ultimately dropped. Now, it seems like Super Train, another parallel that has a Super Train, is it also had life as a TV movie before it became a series. And the TV movie got amazing ratings, or really good ratings. So CBS decided, you know what, we're going to turn this into a TV show. And I'm guessing that CBS, just like NBC more or less, was capitalizing on the Love Boat trend. Oh, here's a funny sort of super transportation or transportation. Let's make a series of it. And yeah, in case you didn't notice, CBS had Flying High on a plane, and NBC had Super Train on a train, and ABC had the Love Boat on a boat. So they all had their own separate type of transportation on a TV show in 78-79, and only one of them would last longer than 78-79, the original, the Love Boat.
Yeah. Interesting thing, though. You look at the three particulars, Pat Klaus, Catherine Witt, and Connie Sulica, could very well also be sort of a sub-copycat of Charlie's Angels.
Which takes me to my next point. The show was a comedy, but really the ultimate draw to this show was the jiggle factor. Something you would have seen in Charlie's Angels, and something you would have seen in Three's Company, and just the over-sexualizing of TV back in the 70s, the T and A. And it reminds me of SNL back in the 70s. There was a fake promo for a Network of the Battle Stars type of event.
And it was Battle of the Network TNAs?
Battle of the Network TNAs. Absolutely.
Oh, I remember this.
Yes. That was the first thing I was thinking of when I saw this, the clips of this, and thought about the other shows that were like it. It's Battle of the Network TNAs on an airplane. Absolutely.
So there you go.
And actually, and as I said, the TV movie had great ratings to the point where they actually ordered the TV show. And it was a funny TV show. One review that I read actually said it's the funniest new TV show of 1978-79. How could this miss? This TV critic said it was the funniest new show of the season. Well, I
so
think
what that, went
I,
wrong?
Well, I think it was the TNA factor that might have cost it, and I'll tell you why. The time slot it aired in was 10 p.m. on Friday nights. How many comedies can you think of that aired at 10 o'clock, strictly comedies, that aired at 10 o'clock on Friday nights?
I can't.
I've got one, and I know Greg's going to hate my response to this. You there, Greg?
Yeah, let me guess. It's going to be Manimal.
No. That was 9 o'clock, and that's not a comedy.
What is it?
The Jay Leno Show.
Oh!
Well, it's a comedy of sorts. I know as much as we dislike Jay Leno in these parts. But
Jay Leno was the reason Gabrielle Union got fired from AGT. Bump him!
Yeah. He's a racist.
The following remarks do not represent Mike Klaus or this podcast. Send all hate mail to Chico and Greg. But yeah, I mean, what comedies have aired, strictly comedies have aired at 10 o'clock at night? Not really any. I mean, you'd usually see comedies ending at 9:30.
Yep.
And even if you had comedies sort of in the vein of Moonlighting, they were sort of adult comedies, which were sort of transitioning to the more mature type of programming you'd see at 10 o'clock. So I really think that's what killed it in the end was the 10 o'clock time slot. If you moved it and maybe had a little less jiggle and put it on at 9, maybe you would have had something.
Jiggle is not a substitute for plot development.
Yeah. They did have a very good lineup of guest stars, unlike Super Train. I got to give him a ton of credit there. Just going through the episodes, let me tell you the guest stars on each episode. On the pilot, the two-hour movie, you had Marsha Wallace. Hey, Marsha Wallace would have ended Bob Newhart not too long before.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, she was a known quantity. Episode one, Bill Daly, another alumnus of the Bob Newhart show. John Hillerman.
Who would have just, I don't know, he would be 2 or 3 years before Magnum.
Right, that would have been about 2 years, 2 to 3 years before Magnum. And then Jerry Mathers as the Beaver. Well, maybe not as the Beaver, but Jerry Mathers was on the first true episode. And then second episode, George Gobel of the Squares. James Gregory. Rosie Greer.
And Michael Parks.
Yeah, Rosie Greer probably needed a seatbelt extender and probably 2 seats. Well, he probably did. He's a big guy.
He was a big guy.
Episode three, you had Broderick Crawford from Highway Patrol and Scatman Crothers.
And he would have just be working on Zapped, if I'm not mistaken.
And Ross Martin, who's somebody who did the game show circuit quite a bit back in the 70s. Episode four, again, big names. Eve Arden. Rose Marie, another square, and Jackie Mason. So you got your Borscht Belt there. Episode five, you had John Carradine. Six, Bill Bixby. And that would have been about the time of Incredible Hulk.
Yes.
Hermione Baddeley.
Who?
She was on Maud. She was like the housekeeper on Maud.
Okay.
Nell Naugatuck. So again, that she would have just gotten off of Maud because Maud was canceled ended in 78. And then Pat Carroll, who's done like everything. Jackie Coogan. Oh, Greg's favorite, Tom Poston.
Oh my God! Do you think it took him like 30 minutes to board the plane?
No, he probably fell asleep on the plane, and then once they landed, what do you mean we landed half an hour ago? And then episode seven, you had Alejandro Rey, who was from The Flying Nun, and Bobby Vann, but no sign of Elaine Joyce, interestingly enough. Episode eight, Jim Backus, Mr. Magoo.
And Mr. Howell.
And Mr. Howell. And Nancy Dussault about... Well, this would have been about a year and a half before Too Close for Comfort.
Yep.
What? Dave, wait, Too Close for Comfort didn't premiere until like 80?
Yeah.
Well, it was on for a season and a half on ABC before it made the jump to syndication.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was all about right. 80 that Too Close for Comfort started. No, okay, hold on. We're going to take a look at this.
I'm looking at it right now. Too Close for Comfort aired on ABC from November 1980 to May 1983, and in first run syndication from April 7th, 1984 to February 7th, 1987. Okay, so that explains the special week with Too Close for Comfort on Matt Game Howard Squares.
Right, and also, it said till 87, but the thing is, that was known as the Ted Knight Show in syndication for that last season.
Okay. And well, then after his death, it got folded into the Too Close for Comfort package.
Right. Yeah, they put the Too Close for Comfort name on it. So after Jim Backus and Nancy Dussault, here's another name, just passed away in the last couple of years, Dave Madden, Reuben Kincaid on Partridge Family, and another name of somebody who just passed away very recently, Charlotte Ray.
Oh, my
girls,
God.
Girls!
Charlotte White Ray, who also shows up in future induction, Thunder in Paradise.
Oh, jeez. And Bobby Sherman and Lyle Wagner from The Carol Burnett Show. Yet another CBS show that had ended its run by that time. So it seems very interesting to me, at least, that all of these cast-offs from CBS shows are appearing on Flying High. Episode 9. Again, more names. I mean, this show's like crapping out guest stars. Shelley Berman. who Chico and I remember from the Game Show Congress about 14 years ago. Hilarious guy.
Incredibly hilarious.
Sadly, no longer with us. Dr. Joyce Brothers.
Who is known for being known.
Well, she's known for more stuff than that. But yeah, she's another one of those made the rounds in the 70s and 80s. Jack Carter. Jack Jones. Yeah. Wait, Jack Jones. The irony is, who sang the Love Boat theme? Jack Jones.
Yes.
And then Ann Southern. She of the Ann Southern Show. Episode 10. Kay Ballard, who just passed away within the last few months.
Also sad.
Charo, Coochie Coochie.
Jiggle.
There's your jiggle factor, exactly. Alan Hale Jr.
Angus Grimsby, the skipper.
Yeah, the skipper. Red Skelton. And he probably wasn't a big name back then, but he's more famous now for something else. Vince Van Patten.
Yeah.
He went on to host the World Poker Tour with Mike Sisson.
Right, right. And I'm wondering if this is the poker episode of Flying High, where they show the poker tournament on a closed caption or a closed circuit TV.
And also, another guest star, Jekyll Halloran, who played the Kryptonian nun in General Zod's trio in Superman 1 and 2.
Episode 11, again, more guest stars, Dodie Goodman.
Well, he was on Punky Brewster, if I'm not mistaken.
Jodie Goodman would have been female.
Oh, she was on Punky Brewster.
I'm sorry.
She was the mother. Jodie Goodman was the mother in the series Mary Hartman.
And again, another show that would have probably bit the dust by about 77, 78. I'm sorry, I'm dead. Dodie Hartman, he was. No, Chico, she was. Yeah, that died in syndication in May of 77. Mary Hartman. And then, okay, here we go. Again, amazing. Bernie Capel, he got off the boat and got on the plane.
And then would later go on a train.
So he did all three types of transportation in 78, 79. Oh my gosh. Mind blown. And again, keeping up with the alumni of Gilligan's Island, Natalie Schaefer.
Lovey Thornton.
Lovey, yes.
Lovey.
Episode 12. Oh, Robert Goulet. Everybody knows Robert Goulet. And the other name that is recognizable to me is Arnold Stang.
Yeah, because he was the co-star with Arnold Schwarzenegger in his first movie.
That wasn't even where I was going with that, but I thank you for playing. Now, Arnold Stang, see, the way I remember Arnold Stang, he was the voice of Top Cat on the TV show Top Cat. Stop laughing. I can hear you and I have feelings. Really, there's nobody of consequence in episode 13, any big guest stars. 14, you had Hoyt Axton.
Hoyt Axton, best known for playing Billy's dad in Gremlins.
Uh-huh.
And you had Bill Dana.
Ooh, I know who he is. He made the round. He's another one who makes the rounds all over the place. But yeah, Bill Dana is actually quite known for. This is how known he is. I know he plays somebody. I just don't know who it is. I know it's a character. I just don't know who it is. Bill Dana is known for playing Jose Jimenez on the Ed Sullivan Show.
He played Jose Jimenez. But also, he had his own self-named TV show, self-titled. So, yeah, he was definitely a known quantity.
Dick Gaudier.
Dick Gaudier was on this episode. Dick Gaudier, who played Jaime on Get Smart. And he also played Robin Hood in Future Installment. When things were rotten. Yes. And Arthur Godfrey was also on this episode. So you had
that son of a bitch.
Yeah. So, I mean, you had like four legitimate guest stars there. And then episode 15, there's John Hillerman again. And along with John Hillerman, again, the only other name that I recognize is Marvin Kaplan. And you're like, who's Marvin Kaplan? He was on Top Cat 2!
You have an almost alarming obsession with Top Cat, my friend.
Okay, excuse me. I have two cats. What happened to be their names? Banoodles and...
TC, yeah.
And what do you think TC stands for?
It stands for Top Cat.
Among other things, absolutely. So, yeah, so I may have sort of, encyclopedia-like knowledge on Top Cat, but I love that show. My cat's freaking named after Top Cat. So, yeah, Marvin Kaplan played Choo-Choo on Top Cat. Episode 16, you had Roddy McDowell. Oh, who was also on Super Train, Greg.
Yeah, he was probably getting ready for that big poker game.
He was probably flying to the airport to get on the train for the poker match, absolutely.
Did he have a suitcase with him? Because everybody in that poker episode had a suitcase full of money.
Well, you don't just, like, carry around $100,000 in your back pocket.
You do in the 70s.
Yeah, and that's why you have no money in the 80s.
Marianne Mobley.
Marianne Mobley, yeah. She was a big name at the time. And Greg Mulavey. He made the rounds in the 70s, too. And actually, that episode never aired. That's one of those 300 episodes. Yeah, all episode right, 17. Again, the big names keep coming. Marty Allen.
Funny guy.
Funny guy, crazy hair. Again, just passed away like in the last year or two. Very sad. Another of Greg's favorites from the first week of Match Game Hollywood Square is Barbie Benton.
Roll Tide!
Yeah, Roll Tide. I love obscure inside jokes, but yeah. She was not Twyla Littleton, though.
There's nobody compares to Twyla Littleton, excuse me. Nipsey Russell was on.
I bet he told the stewardess this is an amazing poem.
Oh, I'm sure he did.
Mm-hmm.
And also Andrew Prine, who is another one of those people that maybe you don't know the name, but he's had a number of appearances over the years. His career's gone back about 50 years. He's on one of the episodes of The Game, the one that GSN showed about 20 years ago. Not that, you know, it makes a difference if you could name him from that. But also he ended up playing Psycho Dad on Married with Children. See, that's where I remember him from, Psycho Dad.
Nice.
Oh my gosh. And then the last episode, you had Bill Daly again. You had Heather McRae. And we mentioned Greg Mulavey and Meredith McRae. And Heather McRae was Meredith McRae's sister. So it's just very interesting that we mentioned Greg Mulavey and Meredith McRae, and here's her sister on the final episode, which never aired. So yeah, it was sort of like Love Boat-ish, but in the air. And it had the guest stars you'd see on Love Boat, but it just died. The ratings were not that good, even though it was, like I said, supposedly the funniest new show on TV in 1978. And actually, the one takeaway I got from this show, not in terms of the show itself, but when it got canceled in early 79, what show replaced it?
On CBS?
On CBS, 10 p.m. on Friday.
Not Landing?
Not Knott's Landing. You're in the right area.
Dallas.
Dallas was originally on Sunday nights at 10 o'clock. Then it went to Saturday nights at 10 o'clock. Then back to Sunday nights at 10 o'clock. And that was the show that replaced Flying High. And Dallas was at that Friday 10 p.m. time slot till it ended what was it, about 92, 93-ish.
Yeah.
Oh, I know I'm going to hear from some friends about this because they're big Dallas fans. But yeah. Dallas ran for like 14 seasons or 13 seasons in that Friday at 10. That was like a stalwart in CBS's lineup after that.
Yeah, Dallas ended 91, Nuts Landing ended in 93.
So, yeah, I mean, it lasted like 12 and a half, 13 seasons after Flying High got canceled, which is... I just think pretty amazing. A very interesting footnote in history that Flying High was the last show before Dallas in that Friday night time slot. But yeah, it was supposed to be a funny show, and like I said, it was you know some critics said it was the funniest new show of the year, but also at the same time, as we mentioned, the jiggle factor. And there were critics who said, A, it's sort of demeaning against women for obvious reasons because they're, well, as we said earlier, the TNA factor. But also it's trying to rip off Charlie's Angels, and it's very stereotypical. The usual stuff you'd probably hear about a show that uses females in that manner.
Yeah.
I mean, Married with Children went through so many issues over the years for basically the same reason.
I have a list of all the jiggle shows according to Knowledge by Consensus Wikipedia. Yes, we have The Battle of the Network Stars,
of course.
Baywatch, Charlie's Angels, The Dukes of Hazzard, Fantasy Island, Hee Haw, I Dream of Jeannie, The Love Boat, Married with Children. Perhaps future installments on this podcast, Sugar Time. I have no idea what that is either. Three's Company, Two and a Half Men. Definite future installments on this show. We Got It Made. WKRP in Cincinnati. Wonder Woman and Xena Warrior Princess. And those are just the most notable ones.
I'm sort of, and maybe I haven't seen enough of these shows to merit them being on this list, but when I think of Fantasy Island, I really don't think of the jiggle factor.
No, well, they probably got on the list because Barbie Benton was on more than a couple of episodes.
Yeah, that'll do it. And, well, Dukes of Hazzard, well, yeah, I mean, Daisy Duke, but beyond that, there really wasn't much of a jiggle factor unless Boss Hogg was doing something, but I'm not going to get into that. Well, I'm just being honest. And yeah, Wonder Woman definitely fits in that. WKRP, I mean, there's one reason WKRP would be on the list. Surprise, surprise. Lonnie Anderson, obviously.
Obviously.
Obviously. But I mean, the rest of them make sense. Sugar Time, just very briefly. Oh, 11 episodes. Plus two unaired episodes. ABC 1977-78.
I'm adding it to the list right now.
And, oh, wait. What did we say, or who did we say was the big factor in Fantasy Island being on the list?
Barbie Benton.
She was on Sugar Time.
Oh, yeah, that's definitely going on the list right now.
And actually, Sugar Time was produced by James Comack, who would have been behind Welcome Back, Cotter.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome back, indeed. Oh, gosh. I'm a Sugar Time. With an exclamation point.
No, oh, that's my.
Well, that's the title. I get that.
Yeah. So, yeah. Is there a... Well, let's just say... A lot of the people on this show, well, actually, two of the people on this show, that wouldn't be the end of their career for doing Flying High, because you have Connie Sulica, who would also be on future installments beyond Westworld, and of course, she would end up being on The Greatest American Hero. Pat Klaus took
and
the...
Hotel,
that's right. Pat Klaus was the Lauren Tweez of the final season of The Love Boat.
Coincidentally, The Love Boat. Yeah, she went from the plane to the boat.
Yeah, whereas Roddy McDowell went from the train to the plane.
And of course, Bernie Coppell took all three.
because he can.
He's a world traveler, that's why.
As for Edward Platt, well,
he's living off of those hoppy residuals from Sanford and Son.
Catherine Witt, who the hell knows what happened to her?
And actually, I'm going to add about Howard Platt really quickly. It must have been about 3 years ago or so, 3 or 4 years ago, there was a car company, like one of those customizable dealerships, sort of like Counts Cars in Las Vegas for Counting Cars and Pawn Stars. They do customizations like that. They actually bought the original Sanford & Son truck. And they actually had a couple Sanford & Son, not necessarily stars, but actors come for like the big reveal of the truck. One of them was the person who played Rollo, who has since passed away. But they also had Hoppy there. They had Howard Platt. And I forget who the other person was. It wasn't DeMond Wilson. But, yeah, they had three people from Sanford & Son there. And if I knew about this, I could have gone to see Hoppy slash the pilot of Flying High back 3-4 years ago.
Oh.
Well, you win some, you lose some.
Thank you. So, yeah, I mean, there's not much of Flying High, but you can sort of see that they're going the same route as Super Train and The Love Boat, albeit more in a sitcom comedy type of sense. And yeah, it's easy to say that. Chico, take it from me.
Yeah, flying high, sexy stewardess and a horny pilot. It may be incredibly tasteless now, but back in 1978 and 1979, it was a thing on TV.
And it was on Friday nights before Dallas, so that's memorable in and of itself. All right, well, I think we're going to put the bow on this one.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome to a very special installment of the It Was a Thing on TV podcast, episode number 16, entry number 121, the Star Wars Holiday Special, airing on CBS November 17th, 1978.
Chica, what network did it air on?
CBS.
Thank you, Brent.
Also, we should throw in that we didn't play the Star Wars theme for obvious reasons. One is length, because the open is very long. Number two is Disney, don't sue us.
Right.
Well, given the amount of places that the Star Wars Holiday Special is readily available, I don't think they're worried about that.
No, I mean, you'd think that years and years ago these would have been taken off the internet, but they either don't care about it or they just want everybody to suffer like I did.
Yeah, you would think that would be. You would think that now that Disney owns the Star Wars everything, they try to cash in on nostalgia plus cheese.
Oh, and also, I'm sorry. I just thought of something very interesting. Doing the episode this weekend, and we're doing it on Friday. And what opened today is Star Wars Episode 9. One more because Disney needs the money.
Well,
I think it's the subtitle. Episode 9, one more because Disney needs the money.
Well, as long as I'm still waiting for Spaceballs 2 to search for more money, Mike.
Yeah.
Oh, there
wait, you go. 751. Spaceballs the series. 751.
I'm conflicted because I love Spaceballs, but no. Okay. And the thing is, I'm sorry, if they ever do a Spaceballs 2, Mel Brooks is close to 95 years old, and I don't think it would get the justice it deserves.
Okay.
But enough about that. We're talking about something that's worse than Spaceballs.
Okay.
Well, guys, Star Wars, when it premiered in 1977, was a runaway success. It was such an unexpected hit that even the toy company that was making the action figures for Star Wars did not anticipate how successful this movie would be.
Yeah,
In Christmas of 1977, they didn't have the action figures ready.
Oops.
Boo on you, Kenner. But, it seems like when Star Wars first came out in 1977, it was a clean break. Everyone ended. The good guys won, the bad guys lost, and everybody was happy. Just one problem with that. It was a big hit. And now, 20th Century Fox wanted more. Well, George Lucas wanted more money. Anybody. Anyway. But, yeah, it just... Okay, how can we milk this thing for all it's worth? Enter the 70s, where you have... It seems like the entire cast was on that episode of The Muppet Show, which was a really good episode. And it was really well received, to the point where 20th Century Fox, in all of its wisdom, teamed up with Steve Binder and CBS to produce... The Star Wars Holiday Special 1 year later. It really took a year to make this piece of crap.
I know. Well, before we get to that, I should mention that the Star Wars Holiday Special was not the first Star Wars Network special on TV. In 1977, there was The Making of Star Wars that aired on ABC, and... Who narrated the making of Star Wars, you ask? Well, it'd be none other than the narrator of Manimal, William Conrad.
Wow. He is... Wow, William Conrad narrates the hell out of everything.
Roar!
You know what
The Star Wars Holiday Special.
No, no, no. It's... Row! The making of Star Wars.
Yeah, you're getting ahead of yourself, Mike.
Yeah. And also, it should be noted that George Lucas, in case Star Wars was not a hit, he actually had a backup plan for Star Wars in case it wasn't a hit. His original idea for a Star Wars sequel was a low-budget made-for-TV movie called Splinter of the Mind's Eye, and he had Alan Dean Foster, an acclaimed sci-fi writer who wrote Ghost wrote the novelization of the original Star Wars movie. He wrote the novel of the proposed sequel, Splinter of the Mind's Eye. And it was basically, if you read it, it's a low-budget idea of a kind of low-budget kind of movie. Luke and Leia are searching for something called the Kyber Crystal on a planet. Darth Vader's there. And, of course,
it was very... Yeah, to say it was very... that seems very low budget, very bush rank. But then Star Wars made a big hit, and that had to be scuttled for something a little bit more expository. Enter The Empire Strikes Back. But then there's those 3 years between A New Hope and Empire, so what's a person in search of more money to do?
I've got a question.
Yeah. Yes.
You said that if this was not successful, that George Lucas had this other special that you notice, like a lower resolution or a worse copy or whatever you want to call it, not up to the level of Star Wars.
Not even close.
Okay, wouldn't they have known that, like, almost immediately? I mean, if you look at it, remember, even, like, to tell the truth, back in 78 with Joe Garagiola, yeah, it was in its waning days, and they had an episode, and I believe it was to determine the real Darth Vader, I believe, or something like that.
Yeah, everybody was
capitalizing. So the thing is, wouldn't they have known it was a hit at that time? Because I'm assuming that, you know, to tell the truth, probably stopped recording. Well, let's see, halfway through the season would be March of 78. So they probably recorded that episode, I'm guessing, January, maybe February of 78. I'm trying to determine, you know, how did he not know it was a hit immediately? I mean, I can understand why it would take 12 months, or just about 12 months, for this holiday special to come, instead of just like a one-year anniversary special or, yeah, just some little teaser for, yeah, some filler before you get to The Empire Strikes Back.
Well, to your question, look at when it was released. It was released literally 1 week before Thanksgiving, well, actually 6 days before Thanksgiving. And this was just when the idea of Christmas coming right on the heels of Thanksgiving started to take root. So, yeah, let's make it a bit of a holiday thing. But here's the thing. Because, again, what we also had, this was also the age of Christmas in the Stars, so they were milking the whole Star Wars thing for ages. But here's the thing. This is not necessarily a Christmas thing per se. And it was in the midst of, it was the last Friday of November sweeps. So, hey, let's cash in on the Star Wars deal. And we have the plot line. And again, this is one of those things that ties A New Hope to Empire in the loosest way possible.
Well, I'll tell you what, guys. Before this starts, before we start talking about the holiday special, I want to talk about one thing.
What's that?
Fighting the Frizzies.
Fighting the Frizzies?
Yes. Fighting the Frizzies at 11. Okay. The reference here is, in one copy of the Star Wars holiday special, before it starts, it's a copy from WCBS2 in New York. And there's a news anchor teasing the 11 o'clock news lead story, and it's Fighting the Frizzies at 11. And it became so iconic in a bootleg tape that was passed around all over the years that back in 1999, Trey Parker and Matt Stone referenced it in the South Park episode, Mr. Hankey's Christmas Classics.
I remember that episode, yeah.
Now I'm going to have to go back and take a look at that episode.
Yes, you do, sir.
What are the Frizzies? That's what I'm curious about.
I don't know, but apparently in 1978, they had to be fought.
That's for damn sure.
Yeah, we weren't in any sort of war in 1978, so we had to create our own war, the war against the Frizzies.
This was before cable. This was before cable had a monopoly on culture wars, you see. Right. Yeah, I went there.
All right, let's get to the special, what we all came here to listen to.
Okay, yes. Okay, so after the events of the original film, Chewie and Han Solo pilot the Falcon to Chewie's home planet of Kashyyyk to observe something called Life Day.
Life Day?
Life Day. That it can never be a simple trip, i.e. Harold and Kumar goes to White Castle. They have to make a bunch of stops, they have to run into a bunch of people, and of course, because Darth Vader is still a little bit mad about what happens during A New Hope, remember, this was before he and Luke had a heart-to-heart in Empire, spoiler alert, yeah, he decides to send his stormtroopers ahead of Chewie and Han to Kashyyyk to try and ambush his family, which consists of, and I am not kidding here, his father, Itchy, his wife, Mala, and his son, Lumpy. If it sounds like it doesn't make any sense, it is because it indeed doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, those names sound so non-canonical. Lumpy and Itchy. I mean, it sounds like they have skin conditions. They're not Wookiees.
Yeah. The trip uses many of the same sets, props, and footage from the movie because, yeah, it's a television show. Of course you're going to splice movie footage. Save on the budget. Come on, people. This is how you do TV back in 1978. Anyway, so the family started to get worried, and Mala contacts Luke Skywalker, who is working on his X-Wing, and Luke tells her that he doesn't know where Han and Chewie are, so Mala contacts Son Dan, a human trader, who tells her through a carefully worded message that Han and Chewie are on their way and should be arriving soon. Then Mala hires a chef, but not just any chef, Chef Gormanda, played by Harvey Korman.
Well, let's get one thing straight. Mala is watching a cooking show starring Chef Gormanda, and Mala actually in Wookiee speak says hello back to Chef.
Yeah. you can tell George Lucas did not write this. Anyway.
Oh no.
Oh wait, it gets better. So San has Life Day gifts for everyone, including a VR fantasy program involving Diane Carroll. Because
now,
who doesn't
here we go.
Cause who doesn't want a VR fantasy program involving Diane Carroll?
All right, Mike, let's hear your thoughts about this.
Okay, first off, what did Diane Carroll have on her head? I mean, what was that? Her hair was some hot mess, as the kids would say.
And remember, this was a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. Nobody cared.
It goes beyond the galaxy far, far away. It has also to do with, you know, George Lucas didn't give a darn. But yeah, Diane, there's like so much I didn't understand. And I'll be the first to admit, I know as much about Star Wars as I do about nuclear physics. Pretty much all I know is that somehow Jean-Luc Picard is on the Enterprise.
Michael, what's wrong with you?
Well, okay, my Star Wars experience is limited to going to Empire Strikes Back in 1980, and I remember going with my dad and my then, he would have been probably 17, my 17 or 16-year-old uncle, and I had no idea what was going on, and honestly, almost 40 years later, I still don't.
Okay. All right. Well, getting back to while Itchy is playing with Diane Carroll, God knows what they're doing, Lumpy hears a roaring of a ship. Mala opens the door, but does she find Han and Chewie? No. She finds two Imperial stormtroopers.
I noticed that the VR headset wasn't even over Itchy's eyes when he put it on. So how did he get to enjoy it unless it, like, interfered with his brain waves?
They're just making it up as it goes along, so man might have connected to his brain waves. Who knows?
What the hell is the deal with the acrobats and the tumblers and those people in that?
I did not get that.
It just made no sense.
The only thing I can think of is they need filler.
The first 10 minutes of this is just Chewbacca's family and Wookiee speak and the acrobatics. I can only imagine the adults watching this in 1978 being like, what the heck is this?
Yeah, like anybody over the age of about 30, I'm sure, is like, this is like, but not just stupid, but like trippy. Unless they went to go see the movie, I'm sure, you know, maybe if they had a little bit of the backstory, it might make some sense. But this, this is clearly on for the kids in 1978, not the adults.
Yeah, because Itchy's not the only person with a VR headset. Mala has a little something of her own, and it just so happens to play Jefferson Starship, minus Grace Slick.
Yeah, even Grace Slick had enough dignity to say, no, I don't want to do this.
I don't know who got the better deal on the VR headsets. Do I get Diane Carroll or do I get Jefferson Starship without Grace Slick? It seems like six of one, half dozen of the other.
Yeah. But not to be outdone, Lumpy has his own little whatchamajigger, and what plays on it? Perhaps the only thing saving this from complete and utter failure. A cartoon about a search for a talisman involving a bounty hunter by the name of Boba Fett, who saves Luke from a giant monster and claims to want to help the rebels.
This is the first appearance, ladies and gentlemen, of Boba Fett in the Star Wars universe.
Yes, it is. Thank you, Nelvana. They're the ones who animated it. And two more Star Wars properties later on, Star Wars Ewoks and Star Wars Droids, both with involvement from George Lucas.
Hopefully one day we'll get the full series on DVD, Disney. Just saying.
Is it on Disney Plus? I don't know. Anyway, Fett and Chewie return to the Falcon with the cure for Han, who is actually in a mysterious sleeping state thanks to a virus caused by a talisman that they were looking for. Fett blasts away in his jetpack, promising they will meet again. And of course, they do meet again in Empire. Yeah, I guess they haven't really shaken off this whole adventure because Han Solo ends up being frozen in carbonite. Go figure. So, now, because you can't have 2 hours of Wookiees grunting at each other, just doesn't work that way, Lumpy's creating a translation device that will fool the Imperials into returning to their base by faking their commander's voice. Now he has to watch the manual for the device being presented by a malfunctioning, incompetent droid being played by Harvey Korman. Harvey Korman plays a lot of things in this.
I just want to say, this is not the best video, how-to video, if the droid in the video is malfunctioning.
Right.
And you were talking about Harvey Korman. Did you talk about him as the chef, the TV chef?
Yes, he was the TV chef, and he was also the malfunctioning droid.
The one thing I noticed about Harvey Korman's character, the chef, is it just me, or did it resemble Mom from Futurama a little too much?
It wasn't just you, Mike.
No, minus the creepy forearms.
Wait, Mom had forearms. Oh, no, you're talking about... Okay, never mind. Anyway, okay, so while the Imperial stormtroopers are downstairs looking for Han and Chewie, a view screen activates announcing that Tatooine is being put under curfew by the Empire because of subversive forces. Said video was announced as required viewing for all Imperial forces, and much of it features the Mos Eisley Cantina, as run by Akamina, played by B. Arthur.
And this is probably the second best thing in the special. Just B. Arthur.
And then there's Maud.
And then there's Maud singing.
Yeah. And this is also marks the third appearance of Harvey Korman in the special, because he plays an alien who drinks by pouring liquid over a hole in his head.
Yeah. like we said, Harvey Korman plays everybody. So,
it's like the Eddie Murphy of this special.
Uh-huh. And Lumpy uses the opportunity, while the stormtroopers are being distracted by B. Arthur, to put his plan into motion, making a repeated call for the Imperials to return to base. One stormtrooper stays behind, realizing he was tricked. He finds Lumpy, destroys the machine. Meanwhile, Han and Chewie have just pulled into the planet. Chewie protects Lumpy as Han dispatches the stormtrooper, and after they're reunited, an Imperial officer appears on the view screen, giving a general alert for a missing stormtrooper. Song quickly responds that the trooper stole supplies and deserted. Uh-oh. Danger averted. Family prepares to go to the Tree of Life and offer their life day prayers, I guess? Then Wookiees walk into a bright star, and in comes the rest of the Star Wars cast. We're talking C-3PO, R2-D2, Luke Skywalker, Princess Leia, and Han Solo, all joining together in the festivities. Chewie remembers the original film, and Leia sings a Life Day song. And that was the Star Wars Holiday Special.
Oh, that song Leia sings brings a tear to your eye, doesn't it?
Not as much as Heavily Redacted.
Stay tuned for Flying High next on these CBS stations.
Yeah.
And now we get into another great thing about the Star Wars Holiday Special. The commercials.
Are we gonna fight the frizz now?
Well, we already fight for the frizzies. Now we're gonna talking about the Reggie Bar. There was a commercial for the Reggie Bar during this.
Yeah, there was during the first break, yes.
That screams 1978. We had a commercial for a bunch of union people talking about ladies' garments singing a song.
Well, yeah, look for the union label. I don't know if that's a song they sang, but that was something that was that they sang on TV commercials back in the 80s.
Yep.
Yeah, that was on this special.
And then there was a commercial for the show that we talked about on the last episode, something about stewardesses, one of them being played by Connie Selica, another one being played by Pat Klaus, and the third one being played by somebody without a Wikipedia page.
Catherine Witt.
And
it was very provocative, to say the least.
Connie Selica is, like, stripping down. And also, the best part, Ham has a great layover with whom, you might ask? Bobby Sherman.
Ratings gold.
It was sweeps, like you said, and as we said last week, it was an oversexed show, showing off that jiggle factor that we talked about last week.
Yeah. Man.
Bobby, yeah, that, you know what? That was probably on Itchy's VR display. Who knows?
And also, we should say that because of the Star Wars Holiday Special, that's sort of why we inducted or added Flying High to our list.
Yes.
Because otherwise this episode wouldn't make sense.
No. And also, it should be noted about the cast of the Star Wars Holiday Special. Kenny Baker, who played R2-D2 in the films, was not involved in the special. R2-D2 was performed entirely by a radio-controlled unit. R2-D2 is credited by the announcer as playing himself. And fun fact, who was the announcer of the Star Wars Holiday Special?
Art James.
Yes.
Fresh off of the future installment, Magnificent Marble Machine.
Well, not fresh. I mean, that's 2.5 years, almost 3 years later.
Hey, years is a long time in the 70s.
But he was fresh. I mean, there wasn't much fresh about Art James in 1978, but continue.
And also, because James Earl Jones was originally uncredited in Star Wars, this special marks the first time he was ever credited as the voice of Darth Vader. And here's something for you, Mike. You were talking about how the names were of Itchy and Lumpy were just like, what the heck? Well, here's the thing. The names of Chewbacca's family have been later explained to have been nicknames. Their full names being for Mala, Malatalo Buck, At, for Itchy, I can't even pronounce this.
Achitichuk?
Yeah, that one. And for Lumpy, Lumpa Walrump or Lumpa Walru. I think. I don't know. It makes sense why they shortened the names to that.
Sure, whatever.
All right, Chico, go back to what you were going to say.
That was actually what I was going to say. I mean, you had everybody on. You had everybody on Star Wars, and you combine that with, oh look, let's throw in a variety show just for fun. So you basically had 90% of the cast of Star Wars, the rest of the cast appearing in archival footage being spliced into the movie because, hey, you can't do a variety show for 2 hours and expect it to make some sort of sense. Although, let's be honest, this didn't even make sense when it was properly done. But I got the... Lucas imagined a film just about Wookiees, nothing else. And that was sort of the seed of this whole enterprise. And according to writer J.W. Rinzler, everybody agreed that a television special was a good idea. So a television special just about the Wookiees and nothing else. CBS bought it, and unfortunately, Lucas was busy on Empire to have any say-so in it. So who did most of the writing? It wasn't George Lucas, it wasn't Lawrence Kasdan, hell, it wasn't even a 10-year-old J.J. Abrams. But we will get to that. It was, check out these names here, Pat Proft, Leonard Ripps, Rod Warren, Mitzi Welch, and, are you ready for this one, Bruce Valanche.
Boy, that's a long way from Hollywood Squares.
Yes, it is.
Well, that's one way to definitely cut your teeth in the industry. It was a pain
everybody's
gig.
Everybody's got to take their first sip of the blue milk, as they say. See, Greg knows what I'm talking about. Anyway!
Just ask Luke in The Last Jedi.
Mm-hmm. So... Yeah, of all of these guys, and so they basically said, okay, now we have Lucas, he's uncredited, but it was his idea, and now Lucas didn't want to budge on his vision, because Bruce Valanche was pretty much concerned about the whole, how do you make a movie out of a family that doesn't speak the English language. So, enter David Akoma, who was brought in to make it more variety-ish. And it just so happens that Akoma was a classmate of George Lucas at USC. Yeah, he went to school with me before I did. Akoma and George Lucas were classmates at USC Film School. Unfortunately, they had no idea how to do a multiple camera setup. And yeah, the end result was, well, you saw it. Jeffrey saw a story with a bunch of grunting, a bunch of videos featuring Harvey Korman, music by Jefferson Starship, and acrobatics for 5 or 10 minutes for some reason. Oh yeah, and also the cartoon with Boba Fett, which would prove pinnacle to the rest of the Star Wars universe. Not to mention the unlicensed sound-alike version of the John Williams score.
Yeah. Well, now we go into the legacy of this on Star Wars. And of course, it's kind of funny, considering it was recently referenced in episode 1 of the hit Disney Plus series, The Mandalorian, where Life Day is referenced. And recently, the creator of The Mandalorian has admitted in interviews that he's a big fan of the holiday special, and he would actually be interested in doing a modern version of the Star Wars holiday special. Can you imagine one day we could get a modern day Star Wars holiday special on Disney Plus?
Star Wars Holiday Special 2, Electric Boogaloo.
Bob Iger's gonna be raking that money.
Not Bob Iger and George Lucas, although George Lucas has gone on record as saying he's not really a fan of what Disney's done with the franchise. But you know what? I blame that wholly and solely on the two side story movies, but that's neither here nor there.
Well, guys, the Star Wars Holiday Special, we had Life Day, we had Carrie Fisher singing, we had Harvey Korman in drag, we had B. Arthur at the Star Wars Cantina, we had Chewbacca's dad getting a virtual reality boner.
Oh, jeez.
Okay, that's one way of describing it.
Guys, I gotta say, the Star Wars Holiday Special, a thing on TV.
Rather bizarre thing on TV.
Yes.
Oh, but if you want to know about a real thing on TV.
Oh, yeah.
We'll wait for the next episode.
Yes.
It's one that all the three of us have been waiting for probably the better part of 3 months.
Yeah, if you were thinking, guys, for Christmas about maybe we'll take the family and go see The Rise of Skywalker. No, forget that. Skip skiing The Rise of Skywalker. Listen to our podcast, okay? Because this show that we're about to cover is a show you need in your life.
Oh, absolutely. And we'll give you all the details about how to find it. But, there's no better way to christen your new speakers or your new devices than with our podcast. And then watch your devices commit Harry Keery as soon as you finish the podcast. Oh, it was so bad. No.
Well, it's like, take it to the Apple Genius Bar. Hey, this phone just stopped halfway into this new podcast I'm listening to. Is it the batteries? No, the batteries are fine. The podcast is just about a really bad thing. It's an entertaining podcast, but the subject matter is really bad.
Your mileage may vary on that statement.
Yes.
You might be able to find some joy in what we're going to cover next, but it'll be sort of like Schadenfreude-like joy. Joy in agony, or joy of agony. Well, we got through the Christmas episode. Okay, you guys got through the Christmas episode. I sort of gave up after half an hour because I didn't know what the heck was going on.
You know what? You spent time on Bruce Valanche, and you knew about that, so...
Well, I made it to the end credits because, like I said, I wanted to see the end credits, see if there's anybody worthwhile, and I wanted to see all the commercials.
To be fair, though, I'm sure everyone in 1978 had the same thoughts as you.
Yeah.
No, I mentioned it earlier. I think the younger generation would have definitely been interested, and it aired at 8 o'clock, 8 to 10 p.m., so that was, you know, it wasn't like there was a school night the next day.
No, it wasn't. It was a Friday.
That's what I said. It wasn't a school night. It was on Friday, and also, you know, there probably wasn't a whole heck of a lot of work that was going out because the following week was Thanksgiving, so that means there's probably at most a three-day week.
Well, guys, before we leave, I just want to share one more thing I want to share with you guys before we wrap this up. Mala was played by an actor named Mickey Morton. So you know what that means. At the end of the holiday special, Chewbacca has been kissed by a man. Merry Christmas.
Actually, where I thought you were going, Greg, is that Lumpy was played by Patty Maloney, and Patty Maloney is going to pop up in the near future because she was on the pilot episode of Monopoly. She was Mr. Monopoly, Rich Uncle Pennybags, that ran around the board. Yeah, that didn't make it to air.
The one that pissed off Peter Tamarkin.
What didn't piss off Peter Tamarkin? But yes, Patty Maloney is one and the same.
Well, there you go. Now the question is, how do we end this disappointment of a show? And Greg, it looks like you have something. What do you have, Greg?
Well, guys, to play us out, let's hear from Harrison Ford on Late Night with Conan O'Brien back in 2006 when he was asked by Conan about the Star Wars holiday special.
I wanted to ask you for a while, and I've always restrained myself.
Yeah.
Star Wars, of course, came out 1977, I believe. Huge international hit, one of the biggest hits of all time. Rockets you to superstardom. And then shortly afterwards, a Christmas special came out that was produced by George Lucas, in which all of the participants in Star Wars came together, and they made this Star Wars Christmas special, and the tape's been passed around for years, and the rumors that Lucas is trying to suppress it, because none of you look happy while you're making this thing. And I thought I'd just ask you about it. Do you remember making this Christmas special? I think it was 1978. No, you don't remember it? This incident.
No, none whatsoever.
No memory of it at all.
No,
so it doesn't exist in your...
No, it doesn't exist.
It doesn't exist.
No.
What if I were to tell you that I had a little piece of tape right now? What if I were to roll that piece of tape? How would you feel about that?
I wouldn't feel... I don't know. I've never seen it. Maybe it'll be nice. Go ahead, roll it.
The Star Wars Holiday Special.
Chewie, check and see if the coast is clear, will you? You're like family to me.
Wookie looked at you with lust. That was
real affection.
Quasi affection, yeah. All right.
Well, guys, that was an incredible look at the Star Wars Holiday Special, and I gotta say, it's very important that at 11 o'clock at night, you have to do battle with the Frizzies whenever you can. But in the meantime, we got some very important shows to plug here at the Place to Be Nation. First, we're going to be looking at the Hard Traveling Fanboys. And this week, in honor of the release of Birds of Prey, which was a very good movie, and you should go out and see it right now. Nick and Greg looked at the DC Universe's streaming app to check out the first episode of future installment on our podcast, the 2002 Birds of Prey TV series. Long maligned, this show has been largely forgotten, but can the boys save it? What works and what doesn't? And what were they thinking? On this week of the NFL, the Cowboy, John D'Amato, and Cowboy Sr. took a look back at Super Bowl 54, giving the hard-hitting analysis you have come to know and love. And after that, Cowboy Sr. goes on an epic reign, dissecting the Mookie Betts situation. Well, I'll tell you what, after the Super Bowl, I got something to say. It was a great day for Kansas City, I tell you what. Siblings Kevin and Barry host the Brother Sister Rewatch podcast. And on the latest episode, they covered episodes 5 and 6 of The Office's 5th season, Crime Aid and Employee Transfer. They discussed a ton of topics during the episode, including Michael and Holly's quick evolution, the return of Roy, the continuation of Dwight and Andy's feud, Michael Douglas, and more. Tim Capel returns to Laugh-In Theater to join Andy Afferton for a live watch of the 1983 Bill Murray classic Groundhog Day. And on the Gren Butler podcast, Our Spectacular Annual Oscar Preview, they took a look at the 2019 nominees for Best Original Score. And for the Place to Be Nation Pop in Memoriam special, Andy is joined by Scott, Steve, and Tim to take a look back at the celebrity deaths of 2019. Also, be sure to check out the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, which includes a dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE through yesteryear. The feed includes the Place to Be podcast, Main Event, Wrestling Warzone, Extreme 3-Way Dance, Jenny of the Gems, Body Pressure Luck, PTB, NXT, and so much more. Subscribe today. And while you're at it, subscribe to Jennifer Smith's The Jenny Position feed as well, as it is the home of Geek and Sassy, Talk and Pop, Freak Out Driving, Telling Stories, and more. And on our social media pages, the Greatest Sitcom of All Time tournament is now underway. We are currently in round 3. There'll be 4 matchups per day, so don't miss a single day on our tournament page on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter so you won't miss a single one. And we have officially kicked off our 2020 stretch project, determining the greatest WCW match ever. You have all year to do your research, promote messages, and build the list. Conversation and rules can be found at www.facebook.com/GWCW matches or on the Pro Wrestling Only message board. And be sure not to forget to check out PlaceToBeNation.com. Each and every day, we have new voices and fresh takes bringing you articles on topics in the worlds of wrestling, sports, and pop culture, including Trent's SmackDown on Fox Report, The Week at WWE by Jon Crow, Paulie's Perspective, Jason's DVD Deep Dive, and Ben's Unpopular Opinion. And don't forget about veteran columns like Glenn Butler's weekly Walk Around the Web. And if you are doing online shopping at Amazon, be sure to check the Amazon banner on the right side of the PTBN homepage or use www.placetobenationamazon, and it will take you right to Amazon and helps PTBN at no cost to you. So let's get back to the show as we go to our Christmas 2019 episode, Mystery Diners. No, I shouldn't have said that. It's not Mystery Diners. It's Joel Styles, Mystery Diners. Get ready for all the fun as we release the drone. Here we go.
Oh, ho, ho, everybody. Merry Christmas. Welcome to the It Was a Thing on TV podcast, episode 17. Submission 223, Mystery Diners. Mystery Diners aired on the Food Network from May 20th, 2012 to April 27th, 2016 for 142 episodes, and it ran 11 seasons.
Tonight on a special episode of Mystery Diners,
you're going to steal from me. Look at me in my face.
We take a look back at the worst thieves we've ever busted. Whether it's stolen food.
He's taking everything out of my restaurant. He's taking everything.
Alcohol.
This is a nightmare.
Supplies.
Are you kidding me? Those bars belong to me.
Or money. These sticky-fingered employees have cost their restaurants millions in dollars.
I cannot believe this is happening right now.
We're counting down the top 10 most brazen acts of theft we've ever caught on video.
I can't take it anymore. I want to go over there right now.
This is Mr. Mystery Diners, millions gone missing.
Now, guys, you may be wondering, why are we covering this obscure show that ran 11 seasons and ran for 142 episodes on, of all things, the Food Network? And you may be asking
Greg,
yourself,
why are we doing that?
Yeah, why the heck are we asking? Why the heck are we asking ourselves this? Why are we covering this show, Mystery Dinos? Well, folks, gotta tell you something. 2 months ago, I was searching on the internet. This was when we were doing this podcast. We were just on this podcast, and I'm on YouTube, and I see on this sidebar, this thumbnail for a YouTube video from the YouTuber Ralph the Movie Maker, and it said, Mystery Diners, worst show on TV. And I thought to myself, that's a bit hyperbolic. The worst show on TV? I have to see this for myself. I watched a 26-minute video of Ralph the Movie Maker talking about Mystery Diners and how bad it was. It was so amazing. I had to tell Mike and Chico this. I told Mike and Chico, guys, look at this. Watch this. Look at this show. We have to cover this on the podcast. And sure enough, eventually, after much digging and finding, we were able to get access to every episode of this show. And let me tell you, folks, you need to discover this show. You need to watch this. This may be the greatest thing that has ever aired on television.
And again, greatest in a Schadenfreude type of way. Our joy from their pain, their agony.
It's the kind of show that you would watch ironically. No, really.
Let's discuss what Mystery Diners is, shall we?
Well, we can't discuss Mystery Diners without first discussing a man by the name of... Jeez.
He can't do it with a string of fingers. I love it! But we're about 5 minutes in, and Chico can't even say the name of the host without cracking up. That's how funny this is.
Charles Stiles. His name was Charles Stiles.
Guys.
Sorry, Greg. What was it?
It's Charles Stiles, Mystery Diners.
and
no joke, that's how he introduces himself to everybody.
Is there a supercut of this? Is there a supercut of him introducing himself? I feel like there should be a supercut.
I think it's on Ralph the Movie Maker's video. Was it, Greg? I mean, maybe
yes,
not necessarily a supercut, but there. I swore I've seen somewhere there's a supercut of opens.
Yes.
So yeah, the show's hosted by Charles Stiles, Mystery Diners. And he just sort of has this... How would you describe it? Almost like boringness in his voice, lackadaisicalness. I mean, he's very bland. I mean, he shows like no enthusiasm, and he sounds like he's saying the same thing over and over, the same inflections, the same tone. Charles Stiles, Mystery Diners. Hi, Charles Stiles, Mystery Diners. Charles Stiles, Mystery Diners. There's like no variation.
No, there is not. It's just the same delivery. Over and over and over again.
Charles Stiles, Mystery Diners.
Well, I mean, that's a common theme in all the episodes because, I mean, it really doesn't deviate from the same plan for each episode. We meet the owners of the different eating establishments being featured, one per episode. And so we find out, like, the backstory. Oh, I, you know, started this after I retired, or I inherited it from my parents, or what have you. And then, you know, we find out what the issue is. Oh, my employees are stealing behind my back. I think that my chef is stealing food and doing catering on the side. We think there's cheating going on at trivia night. And those are all episodes of this show, which I know we're going to cover probably each of those different scenarios in this episode. And then after they figure out the problem, then we sort of get like the breakdown of how Charles Stiles and the Mystery Diners crew like loaded the restaurant or the establishment up with cameras. There's four cameras in the kitchen. There's two cameras in the bathroom. There's three cameras in the employee lounge. There's five cameras outside. And we've got a drone hovering outside. And yeah, and it's just, you know, it's.
There's a lot of cameras.
There's a lot of cameras and a lot of. They cover like every location. Oh, we even have seven cameras outside where they take their cigarette breaks. Don't really there's need to know that. But that's why I said it. There's two cameras in the bathroom. They did get rid of that in later episodes. But yeah, in early episodes, the first seven seasons of episodes, they broke down where all the cameras were, and and there's some outside, and there's some on the patio, and there's some behind the bar. It was a laundry list of cameras.
I don't know why we need to know how many cameras there are.
I don't know why how many cameras, but I think the location of the cameras is integral. It's integral, but also at the same time, it really isn't because, spoiler, most of this show is faked and badly. I mean, this isn't like reality TV. This is like heavily scripted and bad acting. But we'll get to that in a moment. So after we get the whole breakdown of where the cameras are and what's being monitored, then we see the infractions in action. We see somebody overpouring alcohol. We see somebody slipping a side of beef down their pants. Nice, giggity. No. but we see what's going on. What is the reason Charles Stiles is there? And usually every episode, there's at least two, maybe three reasons they're there. Because somebody's stealing tips, or somebody's taking money out of somebody's pocketbook or wallet. There's always a couple of devious things going on. And then we get to the first break. Then they come back and, we just saw, this person, sneezing on the food or whatever. Whatever infraction is happening.
And the best part is, whenever something like that happens, Charles Stiles, Mystery Diner, says to the person, like, for example, Linda's sneezing on the food. Is this a common problem here? Or like, it's like, Linda just blew her nose into that hamburger bun. Is that common for your employees to sneeze their nose at the hamburger bun? Like, I don't know, Charles. What do you think?
Is it common for Charles Stiles Mystery Diners to say, is it common to do something?
Oh, yeah, that's also what we're calling him this entire episode. Charles Stiles Mystery Diners. Yeah, he's not Charles Stiles. We're not calling him Charles Stiles. Maybe he gets called that in everyday life. But no, around here, he's Charles Stiles Mystery Diners. But then another infraction comes up, and that basically fills the second half of the second part of the show, the second segment, I should say, of the show. And then we get resolution for that, and then what happens after that? The owner wants to go outside and confront these people, and, Charles Stiles says, not right. I'm sorry, Charles Stiles Mystery Diners says, not right now. We've got more to show you, or something in that vein. But then, after seeing more, the proverbial poop has hit the fan. Here goes the owner. I want to get at him. I want to see their faces when they see what we figured out. Okay, let's go get them. Let's bring them back here. Now, the thing that you need to realize is back here is either a storage room or some room that isn't used on the premises, or it's some property adjacent or nearby where the restaurant is. And they deck this out. How would you describe it? It's like flat screen TVs everywhere, and they've got blueprints on the board with the suspects, and they've got it looks like a combination of like something you might see in like some sci-fi thing like Star Wars or Star Trek, the monitors on the screen or whatever. Plus also your the pin board you'd see on like FBI shows or conspiracy shows. And the only thing that was missing is the yarn connecting everything together. And the thing is, every reaction when they go back, when the owners go back to this station, this where they're watching everything going on, oh my gosh, look at all the amazing technology in here. Holy crap. It's like flat screen TV, guys. It's pictures of the people you're accusing and pictures of the mystery diners who are going to come in and they're going to play certain roles. Some of them there are occasionally customers or diners. Some of them are sometimes employees. Some of them pose as delivery men. Some of them pose as, let's say, shut-ins who are being delivered like Meals on Wheels types of food. So then, the accused come back with the owner of the restaurant, and Charles Stiles is sort of standing there like a stern teacher with arms akimbo, and, oh my gosh, what is this? And then, boom, show part of the evidence on the video. Boom, show some more evidence. Boom, show some more, not necessarily boom, but they do, yeah, like two or three shots of the video or clips of the video that shows them in the process, being caught in the act. And generally after that, it's, oh, I didn't do it. I didn't do it. That's fake. No, we see it on camera. Okay, please don't fire me. If you want me to reimburse the company or if you really have a heart, give me a second chance. But what happens every time? Well, Billy, I think you're a good guy. You know, you've been nice to my family. You're dating my daughter, but I can't have you around here. You're fired. And then the look of shock. Oh, my gosh, I got fired. Oh. And then after, you know, the owner gives thanks to Charles Stiles Mystery Diners for the hard work he did, then we get the traditional update. 4 months after we taped, Billy's still looking for work. Surprise, surprise. And everything at the OK Cafe has gotten back to normal. Really? And the thing is, it's never, you know, business at the OK Cafe is worse than ever. It's always, it's better than it ever was.
No, you see, Mike, it's all thanks to Charles Stiles with his three diners and his 200 hidden cameras. He magically made the restaurant better. And the best part is, Charles Stiles Mystery Diners, after the restaurant owner has fired the employee, is always like, you know, Jimmy, you have a great restaurant here and people really like this food. I can see why people really will love this restaurant and why you will not have any problems ever again.
Oh, and also, hey, Charles Stiles Mystery Diners, you want a burger? Do you want wings? Let's go have a beer. Charles Stiles Mystery Diners got so much free food from this show.
Here's the thing. It's on Food Network. Of course, you're going to spend 5 or 10 minutes on the food because it's the Food Network, and that's what people tune in for.
I don't think throughout the entire course of the series they spent more than 10 minutes on the food. Well, I mean, they talk about their, what the specialty of the house is. But they wouldn't get into recipes. It was just, oh, well, we're known for our brisket, or we're known for our onion rings. It wasn't like, okay, well, here's how you make the onion rings. You get an onion, you make a batter with flour and eggs and whatnot. No, there's none of that. It's just, oh, well, you know, we're known in the Tallahassee area for our, you know, oversized wings or you know, super spicy hamburger or something like that.
Let's get into what we all came here to talk about.
The details. The bad acting.
The extras, as we would call them.
Yeah.
They were extra, and they were extras. Hence, the extra extras.
And some of the plots were, to say the least, outlandish.
Bizarre is an understatement. Let's just say that.
And I'm trying to wrap my brain around this. How did restaurants contact, and how did different establishments contact Charles Stiles, Mystery Diners? Because you had art galleries, you had motels.
I'm willing to wager that there was a finder's fee involved.
Well, I'm just thinking it's sort of, well, more than scripted, that yes, these are real scenarios, but like everything regarding the production is fake. Not unlike, say, court reenactment shows.
Well, here's the thing about reality television, Mike. Most of reality is incredibly scripted.
Well, I get that, but I mean, if I do a search for Charles Stiles minus the Mystery Diners part, if I just do that, it's the one time this episode we're not going to say Charles Stiles Mystery Diners. If I was to do a search for Charles Stiles, there isn't like a business page that automatically opens up. There isn't like mysterydiners.com or .org or what have you. It just brings you to stuff regarding his show. And not even a production page. It's like Wikipedia. It's like, you know, some of these fan links, the YouTube links we talked about earlier, Ralph the Movie Maker. So how are companies getting a hold of him if he doesn't really have a legitimate presence online? And this is a show, like you said, that we've never heard of, really, until Greg stumbled upon this. If we'd ever heard of this show, how would random art gallery owner or random motel owner in, you know, Idaho or wherever, Northern California, how would they know about this show? But also, if you look at a number of the seasons, they focused on specific locations. One season was done just in Hawaii. One was done just in Las Vegas. Another, I believe, was done just in Florida, in Miami, or maybe Jacksonville or Tampa. So you're telling me that there's that many businesses in Hawaii that watched Mystery Diners and said, I've got to call Charles Stiles to come over here and investigate what's going on at the yacht club? It doesn't ring of reality in that sense, let alone, you know, the reality show, you know, thing you were talking about earlier.
Well, it's probably good publicity for the restaurant, though. They get on TV and stuff.
Publicity is a two-way street. It could be good, but it could be bad. We'll get into some of that stuff later on about some of the restaurants and stuff. But yeah, there's just so many outlandish scenarios. The acting is horrible, and I can't speak for how much Greg and Chico have watched.
I've watched a couple episodes, enough to get the gist of it at least.
Okay. I've seen, and I'm not even joking, probably about 5 to 6 seasons of shows. I've seen probably at least half of the shows, and I'm sure Greg probably tops that number.
Oh yeah, I've seen the same amount Mike has.
Are there any episodes that stand out?
Well, the first one I want to talk about is an episode from season 8. It's called Robbed Kebabs.
Now, I'm sorry, I know what episode you're talking about.
Okay. Gaff and Tiffany, the owners of Dar Salaam in Portland, Oregon, notice a discrepancy in supplies and fear an Iraqi food court that operates near the restaurant may be the culprit. Now, guys, how many times in your life have you seen an Iraqi food court nearby an Iraqi restaurant? Don't even think about an Iraqi food court for a second. How many times in your life have you seen a restaurant that serves Iraqi food?
In Michigan?
No, this was in Portland, Oregon, baby.
Okay, never mind, because if it was in Michigan, I could tell you, yeah, it was a lot of times, really, but
There's a number of restaurants that feature Middle Eastern food here, but I've never heard of any that are specifically Iraqi.
It turns out they were right that an Iraqi food court near the restaurant was the culprit, as they found that the manager and the prep cook were supplying the court with their food, including a Dar es Salaam exclusive dish called mashi. Problems are made worse when another prep cook is stealing onions for personal use. While the prep cook stealing the onions leaves in the middle of the sting, the manager and the other prep cook are confronted by the owners and Charles, and they are both fired. The narrator revealed that the former manager and prep cook found employment elsewhere. The other prep cook has also been terminated and is paid for the stolen onions. Well, that serves him right.
It took onions to steal those onions.
Wow. Did you come up with that just now, or were you writing that down as we were talking about it?
Oh, no, that was on the fly. I'm not wise enough to have done that ahead of time.
For those of you who don't know, I participate in a lot of quiz nights, and I may have been on a quiz show or two in my day. But anyway, this one I couldn't get enough of. It was Season 4, Episode 12, What a Drag.
I'm sorry. I'm not laughing at the name. I know what episode he's talking about. Oh my gosh. This is great.
This is incredible. Bob, the owner of Venture Inn in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, is hearing complaints from both his regular and cross-dressing customers that the weekly quiz night is rigged. By the way, that is completely frowned upon in quiz night, that it being rigged, all right? He suspects his manager is involved. The mystery diners discover that the manager, Joe, is not behind the rigging. Instead, it was the bartender who has stolen the answer sheets from the manager's office computer and giving them to a reigning drag queen champion named Bridget Jones via an earphone in her ear. When confronted by Bob for rigging the quiz night, the bartender is fired for being behind the scam and is to inform Bridget Jones to never return to the restaurant. In his exit interview, the former bartender said that his firing is messed up and Bob hired... Okay. All right, game base, Chico. Game base. Bob hired a D-list Sherlock Sherlock Holmes to investigate the rigging of the trivia contest. The manager is spared when Bob realized he had nothing to do with the rigging. The narrator revealed that the former bartender has found employment elsewhere. Bridget Jones no longer attends quiz night, and the manager added a password on his computer. There's been a different winner each week.
Now, I'm going to take that a bit further.
Please take it a bit further.
Yeah. So the quiz night they had, it cost, I believe, $20 to participate, either $10 or $20, and winner took all. And this Bridget Jones won, I think it was like 10 weeks in a row, and I think the prize each week or the average prize was like $500. So it's not an insignificant amount of money. It's, you know, $5,000 for, you know, participating in this rigged quiz. And she gave the bartender, I think, I want to say 20% off the top or 10%, some sort of finder's fee. So both people profited.
Yeah.
And the way of the quiz itself that night, the person, the mystery diner who participated in the quiz, also got a copy of the questions being used with the answers. And one of the employees of Charles Stiles Mystery Diners, who was acting as a waitress trainee, she went into the computer, which was not password protected, by the way, and printed out a copy of the answers, gave them to Charles Stiles Mystery Diners, or whoever fed the answers through an earpiece to this mystery diner that's participating in the quiz. So what ended up happening is obviously there's a 10-10 tie, 10 questions, 10 right answers. So there's a tiebreaker question, which Charles Stiles Mystery Diners doesn't know about, nor does the bartender. So for all the marbles, the question comes up, And it was, the question was, the first issue of Playboy cost how much money? And the bartender's like, the bartender is being was interrupted because one of the other mystery diners was saying, you know, can you get me a whiskey or a beer? Can you give me a whiskey or a beer while this question's going on? So he didn't have enough time to Google it on his phone. But at the same time, the mystery diner didn't know about the question either, because he wasn't expecting it. So you've got, I forget if it was Charles Stiles Mystery Diners or somebody else, you know, quickly, you know, trying to find the answer to the question. And I think the mystery diner that answered it, he was either given the answer at the last second or he guessed it, and he guessed it right. And so he guessed it right on the nose, 50 cents. And I believe Bridget answered, I think it was $1.25. And just the look on Bridget's face after losing the money. What? I lost? And then as Chico mentioned about the D-list Sherlock Holmes. Yeah, just like everybody's in shock. How could this have gone down? Oh my gosh, you know, this is a giant, this was set up. Oh my gosh. But yeah
it went down like that.
And the thing is, Chico's done enough quizzes in his day. That would never, ever be tolerated, and you would be essentially excommunicated from the quizzing community for that.
Oh, yeah.
But
people people will know you're a dirty, rotten cheater, and they will look at you like that.
Yeah, that was one of the better episodes.
And I've seen it happen in real time.
Yeah, I'm sure that's not terribly fun. It'd probably be very shocking, to say the least. But yeah, that was a great episode. That was a good call, Chico.
Any episodes stand out in your mind, Mike?
One of the episodes that really stuck out in my mind was in Season 10, Episode 9, called History Mystery. The owners of Old Vining's Inn in Vining's, Georgia, begins hearing rumors of unauthorized Civil War tours taking place inside his historical restaurant.
What?
The mystery diners go undercover. Don't tell me you've never seen this, Greg.
I have not seen this.
You need to see this. This is too good. The mystery diners go undercover and discover that one of his waiters is behind the whole scam with a friend of his who knows nothing about the Civil War. For example, saying the Civil War started in Atlanta when the first shot was fired at Fort Sumter in South Carolina. Everybody knows that. That's like history 101, especially in the South. Or claiming that Abraham Lincoln was at the hotel when at the time it didn't exist. He's seen bringing packaged food and ruining the wines by putting vinegar in them, as confirmed by Charles' private investigator Elliot, who's familiar with Civil War history. The owner confronts the waiter and fires him on the spot. Before leaving, he tells the waiter to inform his friend that his Civil War tours are no longer welcome at his restaurant. The narrator didn't reveal what happened to the waiter afterwards, but he did mention that the owner was no longer having problems at his restaurant since the taping of the sting. Yeah, the whole fake Civil War facts, the whole fake, I mean, everything regarding the Civil War tours was fake. And he had this person, this friend of the hotel employee, had done a number of tours throughout the years, unbeknownst to the owner, for whatever reason, either out of town or just, you know, kept out of the loop. And this guy was shoveling totally fake stuff down unsuspecting buyers' throats. And there were also claims that they served authentic Civil War food, or the recipes, rather, which, yeah, I think it was debunked, the whole putting vinegar in wine to make it last longer or whatever. People drank the wine, and they spat it out immediately because it was rancid. And the food was not authentic Civil War recipes at all. But also, like I said, we mentioned the Abraham Lincoln stayed at the hotel. Well, it goes beyond that. Abraham Lincoln used the bathroom or the outhouse at the hotel. And that was one of the big things on the tour. You see that outhouse over there? Abraham Lincoln used that outhouse.
Oh, boy.
That's not really something I need to know. Abraham Lincoln dropping a deuce in the outhouse. But yeah, it was just a whole bunch of like made up lies. They were talking about, I think they were talking about certain soldiers. Don't remember if it was Union or Confederate, stayed in like the basement of the hotel. That's where they hid for days or something like that. Again, all of it is just so fake. And I think you could hear some of the people who are taking the tour sort of questioning the authenticity of the statements, especially the ones saying the first shot of the Civil War happened at that hotel when everybody in like 8th or 9th or 10th grade learned about Fort Sumter. It was a crazy episode. Greg, I got to tell you, you definitely have to see that one.
Okay. Well, I got another episode for you, Mike, also from season 10. Episode 6, Hamburger Burglar.
Oh, not this one. Okay.
Oh, boy.
Yes.
The owners of Latin House in Miami suspect that someone at their off-site warehouse is giving away the recipes to their award-winning hamburgers. The mystery diners go undercover and discover their manager and delivery servicemen are actually behind this. They were caught selling their burgers and recipe to competing food trucks and making money on the side upon it being confirmed by Charles Brown. Private investigator Elliot. The owners also become suspicious of male owner's mother named Chachi, who works at the warehouse as his manager and speaks Spanish, giving away a tray of burgers to a woman following Elliot's stakeout. When all three are confronted, the owners fire the manager and servicemen for their actions. Both men in their exit interview state that the owners didn't let them explain their actions, blaming it on Chachi for shouting at them in Spanish. When the female owner confronts Chachi, she explained in Spanish that the woman is from a local church and she was hosting a charity picnic, which the male co-owner translates for Charles. The narrator revealed that the former manager has moved away from Miami. The former delivery serviceman has found employment elsewhere. Chachi continues to forgive the owners for thinking she was a suspect while continuing to be a loyal worker.
Yeah, these burgers were very prized. That recipe, I mean, like everything else in the restaurant industry, if you have something that's really great, you don't want anybody getting a hold of the recipe. And so I definitely understand where the owners were coming from. But, yeah, I mean, that was like lack of communication between the mother, Chachi, and her son. Because, yeah, if there is some sort of special recipe burger, I wouldn't just be donating, you know, I think it was like 5 dozen burgers. It was like 60 burgers or I think 2 or 3 trays of burgers to this cause. And donating is the key word. I don't think there's any money being swapped. So he's losing money in the process, or at least making donations that he doesn't know about.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, Mike, is this the episode that has the episode where the guy is driving, he disables the truck with like one click of his MacBook Pro?
It might be. I know what incident you're talking about.
Yeah,
I don't know if it's this episode, but one thing we should add is starting in season 8, there was like an upgrade in technology, talking about this laptop where he could disable the vehicle's engine with one push of a button or one click of a mouse. And there's other technology, which we're going to get to later. So you did see different. I use the word technologies very loosely, but yeah, the first 7 seasons didn't have, you know, cars stalling after somebody hits a button or like super sensitive microphones. Oh my gosh, that reminds me of another episode I'm going to cover. I'll let Chico do his episode next, but I know which episode I want to talk about next after Chico's done. It has to do with the technology, and I think that Greg's going to know what I'm talking about when we get there.
Okay, I know my next episode.
Well, my next episode is going to be a repeat offender, and this was from season 9, where you had somebody who was busted by mystery dieters working in New Orleans.
I saw this, yes.
Yes, yeah. Busted the second time, yes.
Okay.
Not you again!
Yeah, that was funny. Kara, the owner of two New Orleans restaurants, Toast and Tut and Tartan, is concerned about an unhealthy competition between them. With help from his private investigator, Patrick, Kara survives to find out from Charles Stiles' Mystery Diners that one of her waitresses from Toast is Dee Dee, who Charles Stiles' Mystery Diners previously busted in an earlier sting, as seen in All in the Family. When she, the manager of Toast, and the female manager of Tartan are confronted with Dee Dee remembering Charles Stiles' Mystery Diners, say it one more time, Greg.
Charles Stiles' Mystery Diners.
No, not you again.
Oh, that was me who said that.
Oh, say it again, Mike.
Not you again!
Yeah. The female manager of Tartan is fired for her behavior. The Toast manager is spared when he stated that the people who visited Toast wanted what was served at Tartan made. Dee Dee apologizes for not admitting she was previously fired and is suspended while commenting that she did nothing wrong this time. In her defense, she didn't do anything wrong that time. She just wasn't really that forthcoming. The narrator revealed that the Tartan manager found employment elsewhere while still claiming that her actions were in the best interest of the restaurant. Dee Dee found a part-time job during her suspensions and has continued to repent for previous actions. So, yeah, people... If you just when you think that people learn stuff from this show, you find no, they don't really.
Yeah, this was an interesting episode for me because when I didn't really realize that if an owner owns two different restaurants, and it's I've never really worked in the restaurant business, but if an owner owns two different businesses. You can't say, hey, can you make me a blank like you the owner makes at whatever other restaurant? Because the two restaurants here, one was like a breakfast nook of some sort, and the other focused on French cuisine. So what happened is somebody called the French restaurant and said, hey, can you make, you know, Eggs Benedict for me or something in that realm? Oh, sure, we'll get it done for you, not a problem. It makes sense because the two restaurants wouldn't necessarily have the same food. I mean, obviously every restaurant has eggs, but would they have the other stuff that you make Eggs Benedict with? Would they have the English muffins and the ham and the hollandaise sauce? I don't know about that, but I mean, and now that I think about it, thinking about the restaurants around here that are owned by where an owner owns more than one restaurant, yeah, I can't really go to Michael Simon's bar and say, hey, can I have one of your burgers like you serve at the B spot? Right. Just doesn't make any sense.
Right.
Well, that was sort of my takeaway.
but this has been another installment of Mike's Takeaway.
That's actually a good name for a restaurant, Mike's Takeaway.
That is a good name for a restaurant.
I'm going to have to save that. That's if I ever get in the food business, I'm going to call it Mike's Takeaway.
That'd be great for one of our T-shirts.
And also, I'm going to request that somebody stop by the restaurant, Charles Stiles Mystery Diners.
Season 2, Episode 1, The Tipping Point. After receiving numerous complaints from his staff that his recently promoted head waiter is not evenly distributing the pooled tips, the general manager of D Cache restaurant in Toluca Lake, California, contacts Troll Styles Mystery Diners and the Mystery Diners to help him discover if there is any truth to the rumor. Charles sends in Destiny and Grant as a customer and a waiter, where they discover that the head raider is telling customers the card system is down and pocketing the money. The waiter tries to set up Grant by stealing an entire bill payment, then asking Grant to fetch the bill. When confronted, the waiter tries to defend himself, saying the manager giving tips to people who haven't earned them is stealing. The manager doesn't buy it, though, and the waiter is fired for his actions. Now, the reason I wanted to bring this episode up is the general manager of the restaurant kind of looks like the twin brother of Sam Darnold. That was my takeaway from this episode, and that's why I wanted to bring it up.
Well, now, I know Chico has seen more than his fair share of Bar Rescue episodes.
Oh, I love Bar Rescue.
I do, too. I don't watch as much as I used to, but it's still a great show. How many times have we seen this scam happen on Bar Rescue? Oh, I'm sorry, I can't, the credit card machine is not working. We're going to have to take cash. It's happened on more than one occasion, I can tell you that. Yeah.
It's happened on multiple occasions.
So yeah, it's like the biggest scam in the book. Oh, I'm sorry, I can't take your credit card for tips because the machine's down. You're going to have to pay cash.
Yeah.
Well, my episode that came to mind is from season 10. It is episode 2, The Art Show Sting. Patricia, the curator of an art gallery in Los Angeles, notices discrepancies with the catering company that she uses to cater her art shows and believes they may be responsible for it. The Mystery Diners go undercover and discover big problems with the caterer's staff eating the food that is prepared for the guests.
Gross.
But wait, there's more. They also discover an even bigger problem with her assistant curator, Michael, who has been behind the discrepancies. He had been conducting some art scams with his friends by talking down on the other artists to help his struggling artist friend and stealing wines meant for the guests to drink to give to his friends. When Michael is confronted, Patricia fires him on the spot and also tells him that his friends are no longer welcome at her gallery shows. The narrator reveals that Michael was unsuccessful at curating his own art exhibits. Patricia has apologized to her caterer, who has fired his troubling employees. It goes beyond the stolen wine. There was, and I'm pretty sure it was in this episode, because I don't think there are any other episodes that happened at an art show. One of the employees contaminated a dish that one of the Mystery Diners was going to eat. I don't know if it was coughed on, spit upon. I'm sorry for anybody who's eating now. But yeah, one of the chefs spat on the food.
Ew.
And the guy had the food on his fork, put it up to his mouth, and like right in the last second, Charles Styles, Mystery Diner, says, "Don't eat that food!" And he puts the food right back down slowly. Yeah, there's nothing suspicious. He's got the food right up to his mouth and then takes it right back down to his plate. And yeah, and then so, yeah, covertly, yeah, "What's wrong with the food?" Yeah. And Charles Styles says, you know, the chef did something really nasty to it. But also, I mentioned the technology earlier. There was a conversation that was being held in some sort of room. It may have been like a, I don't want to say a closet or a bedroom. It might have been a bedroom. So here comes the new technology. And how people don't notice this in an art gallery, in a showing, one of the Mystery Diners has like some high detection microphone that he slid under the door. How would people not notice, you know, this person like kneeling down at the door, sliding this microphone under the door? But also, you had Charles Styles Mystery Diners saying, you know, "Move it fast. They're ready to leave the room because there's cameras in the room." And he gets the microphone out just like at the last second. "What are you doing at the door?"
Whoops.
"Are you supposed to be serving food? What are you doing right here by the door?" And honestly, it's not the first time on an episode where just, you know, the mystery diner or the undercover employee says something in their little microphone, their hidden lavalier microphone or what have you. But it's like, you know, if you're talking like to yourself while at a job, that would look kind of weird. Chico,
I got one more. Okay. I have one more. It's also from season 9. It's the 100th episode of Mystery Diners. Deli drama. The owner of Lenny's Deli in Los Angeles fears that his new head baker is taking artistic license with customer cake orders. He also mentioned that the head baker has had some bad employment at previous locations. The Mystery Diners were able to prove the head baker's actions. In addition, they discovered that the elderly manager, and this is something that, you know, he completely didn't know about until the Mystery Diners brought it up. But, I mean, they knew about the diner taking artistic license and being really sensitive about it, but they didn't know that the elderly manager is conducting a bit of unauthorized shady deals, as confirmed by Charles Stiles, Mystery Diners, and his private investigator, J.R. During the confrontation, head baker is fired, and the owner says to the manager, "You kept talking about early retirement? I suggest you take it." The narrator revealed that the former head baker has put up applications for a job but still remains unemployed. The elderly manager has since apologized for his actions and has retired. The owner has recently promoted one of his more trusted bakers as head baker.
Yeah. So the artistic license with the customer cakes, she was there's a couple of mystery diners posing as a soon-to-be married couple, and they wanted to order their wedding cake. And they wanted a chocolate wedding cake, which is obviously untraditional. It's usually a white wedding cake. And she absolutely refused to do it. But wedding cakes are traditionally white. Well, we want ours to be chocolate for whatever reason. I don't remember the reason. But she was just vehemently, "I'm not going to be doing this wedding cake unless it's, you know, a white wedding cake." And lo and behold, you know, like 5 or 6 days later, they come to pick up the cake. And they look at the cake, and the cake is a white wedding cake. They return it. And the chef, the head baker, just totally goes off. She throws the wedding cake in the kitchen against a window. You see it splattering against the window, much to the dismay of like everybody who could see this and was within earshot. And
I didn't think a cake could do that.
It's actually in the open for the last 4 seasons. There's a part of the video that's shown is her throwing in the montage, the open montage, is her throwing the wedding cake against this glass window, and you see it. You see the frosting or whatever all over the window, and yeah, I'm sure it's since it's brittle, there's little bits of cake there, but she just totally demolishes this cake. She's let go immediately, and then actually the elderly manager who ended up retiring, he was trying to scam people through catering in terms of trying to upsell them on stuff they didn't want and overcharging them quite a bit. And he'd pocket the difference.
Yep.
So the owner would see, oh, okay, you charged, you know, let's say $300 for catering. In reality, the owner would see you charge $300, but in actuality, he may have said the catering will cost $400, and he'd pocket the other $100. So yeah, that was a very momentous episode with the cake being thrown at the window, and just how insistent and how much of a pain in the tuchus this head baker was. Just, "I will not do this for you." Well, you know, there's a phrase, the customer's always right. If the customer wants a chocolate wedding cake, give him a chocolate wedding cake. That's all I got about Deli drama.
Yeah, that I didn't know. I still can't believe that cake could go that far.
Well, but it was not the whole cake. It was like one layer of the wedding cake.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, Greg?
I got another episode for you. All right, here we go. Season 8, Episode 9, Memorabilia Mayhem.
Oh, not this one.
Oh, boy.
Oh, yeah, this one's a good one.
The owner of Rock Island Cafe in Honolulu asks Charles Stiles Mystery Diners for help when he notices a drop in his restaurant's memorabilia sales. The Mystery Diners point to big problems with his manager and one of the waitresses running their own get-rich-quick scheme by bringing in items that they found at home and scamming the customers and buying them. During the confrontation, both the manager and waitress are fired by the owner. His exit interview states that there is no way that the memorabilia can be authenticated. The narrator reveals that the former manager and waitress had found employment elsewhere. The remaining waitress is training hard to become a manager. Now, Mike, let's get into my favorite part of this episode. The fake Don Ho autographed ukulele.
Yes! Yes! Yes.
Nice.
Yes. One of the waitresses says, "Oh, well, we just got an item that you'd really probably like. It's a ukulele that's autographed by Don Ho. We just got it, and it's in the back. Let me go get it." So she goes to the back. She pulls out like a $3 ukulele she got at a thrift store and pulls out a Sharpie marker and signs Don Ho on it. And this is all on camera because, you know, there's cameras everywhere in this restaurant. And so she tries selling this customer this fake Don Ho ukulele, which looks cheap as all hell, for like $150 or $200. And the person that was buying it, I believe, was one of the Mystery Diners. So yes. It's obviously you had Charles Stiles Mystery Diners on the other end saying, "Don't buy it. It's fake. Don't buy it. It's fake." And so, you know, there's the hemming and hawing. Oh, maybe I should get it, but, you know, maybe you could put a hold on it or say that I may come back later for it. And so, yeah, there was no money being exchanged. And, yeah, that person got busted for that. But the other one that I remember from that episode is the toaster.
What about the toaster?
Oh, there's an antique toaster from, I want to say, the 50s. And it was in really good shape. And there was an appliance collector there, coincidentally. And the toaster, I think, had like a price tag of $50 or $60 on it, but it didn't. I shouldn't say it had a price tag. That was the price that the store was putting on it. But how much did the waitress say they wanted for the toaster? I want to say like $75. So, you know, the store got its $50, but then the waitress got the, you know, $25 on the side. And apparently that was one of the scams that was happening. That was a good episode. Okay, Yachi, do you have an episode?
I do, actually. And this is what happens when you crap where you eat. It's an episode from season 3, episode number 6, Friends with Benefits. The husband and wife owners of Nolan's Cafe in New Orleans ask for help getting to the root of why their restaurant isn't thriving. Charles Stiles Mystery Diners and his team discover that the manager has staffed the place with her friends, few of whom are fully qualified, as one of the waiters, who happens to be the manager's boyfriend, was incompetent and was shown taking a break instead of working. The matters are made worse when the manager and waiter were shown eating an order that was messed up and being rude to difficult customers. During the confrontation, the manager and the waiter are fired. Charles Stiles Mystery Diners claims that the bartender that was hired by the manager could be a good employee. While the narrator didn't mention what happened to the former manager and waiter, he did mention that the bartender was offered a full training to be an official bartender, only for her to quit. The owner has replaced the former staff with more competent people. And that was Friends with Benefits.
Worst Friends with Benefits situation ever.
Yeah.
Season 7, Episode 13, Daddy's Girl. Joe and Fran, the married owners of Geppino's Sicilian Kitchen in Moore Park, California, hear customer complaints about the stolen item. Joe's main suspect is McCall, a waiter who's dating their daughter, Brianna, who also works at the restaurant. But Fran is doubtful, notes that McCall is extremely popular with the female patrons. The mystery diners discover that the real thief is an elderly part-time busboy named Al, who is also drinking on the job. McCall is innocent of criminal wrongdoing, but cameras show him allowing a female diner to kiss him and agreeing to go on a date with mystery diner Shelby after having told Brianna that he had to study for an exam. Joe has a confrontation with McCall and Hal with Brianna present. McCall claims that he and Brianna were not exclusive, while Hal claims that McCall framed him. Joe fires Hal and then fires McCall for being a bad waiter and a quote-unquote scumbag as Brianna breaks up McCall. Brianna tells her parents that they did the right thing and she's better off being single for a while. The narrator revealed that McCall has been unable to reconcile with Brianna. He and Hal has started working at a soup. That's great for that supermarket. Yeah, your new employee is on national TV drinking on the job. Great job, guys.
Well, my takeaway from that was Hal. They're showing him on the back patio of the restaurant, and he pulls out a flask, and they say, "Is that a whiskey flask? Oh, I hope there was no alcohol in it." Okay, last time I checked, I don't think I've ever seen anybody put Kool-Aid or milk in a flask. It's alcohol. Lemonade. Surprise. Yeah, it's not lemonade or Kool-Aid or milk or water. It's whiskey or vodka. And they're like, I hope that's not alcohol in there. Okay, you just said it's a whiskey flask. Unless whiskey's not alcoholic, you know. Yeah, he's drinking. But also, Hal was it wasn't mentioned in this for some reason. He was stealing money from people's wallets, and this is another one of those detective snooping around type of things where one of the mystery diners, the one who said she was going to go on a date with McCall, she went to Hal's locker, which interestingly enough wasn't locked. That makes no sense. You know, the optimal part of the word locker is lock, so you should probably keep one on there. She goes into his lunchbox, and lo and behold, what's in there? There's the missing wallet. Plus, also, he did a little scam where while he's bussing the tables, one of the mystery diners left her wallet there. This is the missing wallet that I'm talking about. She had a $20 bill sticking out of the wallet. And so what did he do when he was busting the table? He accidentally, quote unquote, knocked the wallet off the table, and he put it in his apron, then put it in his lunchbox so he could get the wallet and all of its contents. Hal's a mischievous son of a bitch. I'll just tell you that. Got to watch for those old men. If they don't rip you off by stealing your wallets, they're going to rip you off by overcharging you for catering.
Those old men will get you every time.
Thank heavens we're never going to be old. We're always going to be young stallions. I'm going to do this episode next. This is Season 9, Episode 5, Red Hot Mess.
Oh, boy.
Sonny and Sage, owners of Red Hot Bus in Alhambra, California, contact Charles Stiles after hearing rumors that their restaurant is open on the one day is supposed to be closed. The mystery diners go undercover and point to big problems with Sonny's brother Pip, who was recently fired from the business for being useless, running a makeshift Indian restaurant with the manager and head cook that involved imported versions of the restaurant's upcoming special sauce, as confirmed by Charles Stiles, mystery diner's private investigator, Patrick. When the three are confronted, the owners fire the manager and head cook after complaining that they tried to take away selling the first special sauce in America. They claim in their exit interview that they were fired because of family feud. I feel like we need to call Steve Harvey. Pip and Sonny argue, claiming that their parents don't know what was going on, and Sonny tells them never to return to the restaurant. Pip claims that Sonny bringing the special sauce was like him going back home to England to say that he invented barbecue sauce. The narrator revealed that the former manager and the head cook were unsuccessful at starting their own restaurant. Pip was scolded by his parents and has since apologized to and his brother for his actions. Sonny and Sage are preparing to open up a pop-up restaurant with their special sauce. This was totally crazy because, yeah, the restaurant was closed on Sundays, and it didn't mention what type of restaurant this Hot Red Bus was. It was a British food restaurant. Buses being, you know, something, a double-decker bus in London. That's sort of what the logo for the restaurant looked like, was a double-decker bus. And so his brother and the manager and the head cook opened up on Sundays this secret Indian restaurant in the restaurant itself. They put up all new decor for just this one day per week. They'd go in on like Saturday night and Sunday morning, change all the decor, you know, put on stereotypical Indian music. They change the menus. They bring in all their food, the Indian food. And they were charging like an exorbitant rate of money. It was a price fixed type of restaurant where there was no haggling over the price. You paid like $50 a head or $60 a head or something like that. And you got, I think it was like three or four courses of food. And it was just very cheesy the way they did this. But also at the same time, since it was price fixed, they made $60, or not made $60, but they generated $60 per person in the restaurant, which turned out to be like $2,400. And yeah, they split the profits three ways. And the brother was suspicious. Sonny was suspicious because there was food that was missing, supplies that were missing. Actually, it was the spices he noticed. That's what he noticed. He was questioning, why are my spices so low? Why do I have to keep on buying so many spices? So it wasn't, you know, oh, why am I going through 2 gallons of milk on Sunday when I'm not here? It was the spices that tipped him off. It was a goofy episode.
Sounded like a goofy episode.
Okay, I got a good one for you guys. Season 4, Episode 8, Lactose Intolerant. The owner of Cheesy's Pub and Grill in Chicago.
I'm sorry.
No, not Cheesy's. Okay, continue. I'm sorry.
The owner of Cheesy's Pub and Grill in Chicago, Illinois, is concerned about cheating with his grilled cheese eating contest. Too many petite women are among the winners, and the cost of his alcohol sales. The mystery diners point to bigger problems with his waiter, who happens to be his friend, and his cashier cheating to help the female contestants win and giving away free beverages. In spite of his waiter's pleas that it was good for Cheesy's during the confrontation, he and the cashier fired. The waiter in his exit interview said that his best friend fired him over a grilled cheese contest. The narrator revealed that both former employees have apologized for their actions and have moved on to other jobs. The owner has implemented new rules for his grilled cheese eating contest to discourage cheating on both the customers and staff's part. Now, guys, this was a big thing in the Ralph the Movie Maker video about Charles Stiles' Mystery Diners, about the Cheesy's Challenge. Why in the world would you call Charles Stiles' Mystery Diners about a grilled cheese eating competition?
Well, because if you remember, and this sounds quite ludicrous, but actually it isn't, because I'm going to get into the details of the Cheesy's Challenge in a bit, but the Cheesy's Challenge had, what was it, 9 winners in 2 weeks or something like that? The number 9 sticks out. It was 9 winners. I don't remember how long. If it was in a month-long period or a two-week period. And he's claiming that, oh, because I've had 9 winners in 2 weeks, I could go out of business. Really? For 9 cheese sandwiches, that's going to force you to go out of business? That makes absolutely zero sense.
Why not have the competition?
Well, the big thing, and it wasn't mentioned in the blurb you just read, was the payoff for the competition was you got $100, you got a T-shirt. I mean, the usual standard fare you'd get for doing those eating contests. But also, here's where it wasn't really well thought out. An open bar for 2 hours. Free open bar. And I think it wasn't just free open bar for the winner. It was the winner and a friend, or maybe even a winner and three friends. I'm not a drinker, but I know, again, based on watching Bar Rescue, that ain't cheap.
No.
No, I mean, the drinks by themselves, I mean, a single drink probably costs in the range of, I'm guessing, $6 or $7. And you're telling these folks, open bar for 2 hours? I mean, you could lose how many hundreds of dollars? 300, 400? Plus also, that brings up a big liability issue, because if you're over-serving patrons and they drive home drunk driving, you could end up being liable if something happens. So it was not well thought out at all. But interestingly enough... In the last week or so, I decided, since Greg had mentioned it, I went on, I did a little search on Google for Cheesies to see A, if it was still around, and B, if it was real, and C, if they had the Cheesies challenge. The challenge is disgusting in one word. I say that because if you've ever seen Man vs. Food, when he comes to Cleveland, he goes to Melt. And the Melt Challenge is a 5-pound grilled cheese sandwich with 13 different types of cheese. And I bet you there's probably at least four types of those cheeses that I absolutely hate. Oh, I'm sure there's blue cheese on there, which I absolutely hate. And there's probably some other cheeses that I don't care about. But that just sounds disgusting. What this was, it's a 16-inch 8-pound grilled cheese sandwich, takes a 60-minute time limit. It costs $50 to participate. He ate this sandwich, I'm not even joking, in 17 minutes.
Wow, he must have been really hungry.
And, well, the grilled cheese sandwich, it wasn't just grilled cheese. There was other stuff on there. I think there were, like, chicken fingers and ham and other meats.
Okay, forget him. I'm hungry now.
Well, I'm sorry about that. And this was a 5-layer sandwich. So imagine bread, cheese, bread, cheese, bread, cheese, bread, cheese, bread, with other, I believe there are other fillings in between. And it was 16 inches long. It was like 16 by 8. It was huge, massive. I could only imagine the carb counts for that between the cheese and the bread. But this guy nailed it in 17 minutes. And what he got for his reward, he got a $100 gift card, not even $100 cash, a $100 gift card. He got the T-shirt. And I'm not kidding. This is what it says on their website. Unlimited high fives. Free unlimited high fives. Your picture on the wall, just like a lot of places do, a 10% off slap bracelet. I didn't know slap bracelets were a thing in 2019. And a complimentary grilled cheese of your choice to be enjoyed right after you complete the challenge. Okay,
are you kidding me?
You just ate 8 pounds of grilled cheese. Hey, here's another grilled cheese because you defeated it. What sense does that make? At least they got rid of the free bar tab for 2 hours, but now you're giving them a complimentary grilled cheese sandwich because, hey, you just finished off 8 pounds of grilled cheese. Here's a 9th pound. I wish I was kidding, but it's right here on the website. Like I said, Cheesy's Challenge or Cheesy's.com/challenges.
I got nothing. This guy is obviously deranged.
But yeah, so the Cheesy's Challenge, they found ways to throw away the food while people weren't looking or other employees weren't looking. And oh my gosh, it's amazing. This little 98-pound person leveled off this big grilled cheese sandwich in 58 minutes and 55 seconds, right down to the wire. And unsurprisingly, a number of the winners were friends of the bartenders or of the waiters and waitresses, the servers. Go figure. Who knew that there'd be a scam with their friends so they could drink for free on the side while the boss isn't looking?
I'm shocked.
I see your shocked face. I see your shocked face.
This is my flips page over.
Yeah,
shocked face.
Yeah, it's you're very shocked face. Yeah, line shocked face. One for me that this was too funny. This was season 9, episode 9. Too many tourists. The owner of Marigny Brasserie in the French Quarter of New Orleans notices an influx of rowdy tourists at his bar for locals after he has recovered from a heart attack. He suspects it is his manager that's involved, but the mystery diners show him it is really his female bartender who is behind the whole scam with her friend Jamie. The owner is nearly arrested by the police for the rowdy tourists in their drunken state. But Charles comes to his aid and tells the police that the drunks are the ones who started this, and then they're arrested. The owner then confronts both his bartender, who is behind the scheme, and the manager who failed to notice this. The bartender was fired, and her exit interview claimed that she was trying to improve business as she is seen being arrested and taken away by the police. The owner will deal with the manager tomorrow. The narrator revealed that the former bartender was not charged for any crime upon her arrest and has found employment at another bar. Jamie was given a restraining order where she is not to come within 50 feet of the restaurant. The manager's position was given to someone else even after it was proven that he was not involved in the scam. The owner's health improved, and the rowdy tourists kept their distance from the French Quarter and Marigny Brasserie. So what the scam was the bartender's friend was selling bracelets, I think maybe about 50, 100 feet away from the restaurant. Oh, if you go to the brasserie with this bracelet, you're going to get a free drink, or I think it was a free drink and 10% off or 20% off. So, people were buying these bracelets. They go to the bar and say, oh, I got one of your special promotional bracelets. For my free drink, I'd like to have, whatever, a margarita or whatever. And I'd also like to order this food, blah, 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 blah. And so if the bartender, this female bartender, saw it, she knew that this person was part of the scam or got scammed. But what happened is another bartender was approached by a customer who bought one of these wristbands. And, I've got this wristband for the free drink and for the 10 or 20% off the food. And he said, what promotion? We don't have anything like that.
Oh, boy.
Oh, the scam's up. But, yeah, as I mentioned in the blurb, the owner gets arrested, and Charles comes from the secret lair in another room or another storefront and says, no, he's the owner. He's actually trying to help out. Don't arrest that man. And I'm not even joking. When Charles comes out and does this, one of the police officers says, hey, aren't you from that TV show?
And what does Charles say?
I think he just said, yes, I am, or something like that.
Oh.
But he didn't say, are you Charles Stiles? But the police officer's like, you're that guy from that TV show.
I would have said, yes, I'm Charles Stiles, Mystery Diners.
But then, as I mentioned in that blurb, the exit interview with the bartender who is running the scam, she's talking to the camera, and you see the police officer in the back. This almost has like an SNL type of feel, something like a parody. She's talking to the camera, well, if it wasn't for those darn kids, I would have gotten away with it or whatever. And the police officer's like, okay, ma'am, we need to go now. He grabs her by the cuffs at her wrists and, pushes her to the the paddy wagon or the police car. I mean, that's like the episode that cemented in my mind, this is as fake as a $3 bill. You're that guy from that TV show. Are you really kidding me? So obviously the New Orleans police watched Mystery Diners.
You're that guy from the TV show.
You're that guy. I mean, the only thing that was missing was the police officer saying, "Hey, can you autograph my wristband that I got?"
Oh, for the love of God, stop.
Hey, guys, I got an idea. Hey, Charles, could you autograph this Charles Styles with Street Diners?
Stop the pain. Oh, my God.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite episodes, just for how fake the whole thing looked. And Charles Styles running from... Yeah, the hidden room. No, you can't arrest that man. He's the owner. Oh, Greg, do you have another episode?
Season 9, episode 12. Train robbery. The owner of Fillmore and Western Railway in Fillmore, California, is concerned about missing supplies and rumors of unauthorized passengers during his train's dinner theater service. While using the caboose as the control room of a cover-up from the owner that is under maintenance, Charles makes use of a remote-operated drone and plants his private investigator, JR, on the train as a passenger. The Mystery Diners show him that he has a right to be concerned, thanks to an incompetent conductor, a female train manager who has been sneaking her friends in the train past the incompetent conductor, and his head chef, secretly stealing his meat to help his brother save his nearby restaurant from foreclosure. During the confrontation, the train manager and head chef are fired and are told to get off his train and walk back to the station with their friends. The narrator revealed that the former train manager has moved away from Fillmore. The former head chef and his brother have apologized for their actions while reparations are underway. The conductor was also terminated and replaced with a more competent one. No kidding!
So you're saying that this guy was fired? I'm shocked. Look at how shocked I am.
Well, about the meat being taken and given to his brother, this is part of the new technology that Mystery Diners used. They actually put in a GPS tracking device in the bag of meat. You actually saw the meat was actually in like a garbage bag, and the person who stole the meat put it in like a bag of laundry or a laundry cart. So the operative had to go find this laundry cart and then find this bag of meat, open it up, and then throw in a tracking device. And you can see Charles Styles, Mystery Diners, following on his little computer or whatever, his device. Oh, look, here goes the meat. It's going away from the train, and it's going to this sort of suburban area. And the owner of the train said, "Oh, that's where, you know, such and such's brother has a restaurant." and the conductor like stopped the train every now and then, and some of the train manager's friends would hop on the train, and it wasn't like one or two at a time; it was like six. And then, you know, ultimately, how did they get caught? Well, we had enough food for everybody on the train. We had, you know, 50 meals ready. Why did we have to have, you know, 56 or 60 people request meals? And so that's when, you know, the whole scam got figured out from that angle. But, yeah, that was a great episode. Oh, my gosh.
Okay. Unless you think that all they do is find the shortcomings of restaurants, here's the first episode in which something good, not bad, is found. It's season 6, episode 4, Charitable Donations. Doug, the owner of Pelon's Tex-Mex in Austin, Texas, hears about his staff collecting donations for an unauthorized charity. The Mystery Diners discover that the manager, Anthony, as well as the other staff plan to give the money they made to a real charity, the one Doug sometimes donates to, which involved male staff members shaving their heads to prove their legitimacy and to have their heads be like Doug's head. During the confrontation, Anthony accepts responsibility for his actions, and he's reprimanded along with the others. The narrator revealed that Doug continued to donate the money to charity, and the staff only focused on their jobs. So, yeah, there are times when there's some good that comes out of this, even if it is kind of, well, strange. It's a strange show.
That's putting it nicely. It's a strange show. We're going to cover two more episodes. We're going to save what we think is the best for last. And the one that that Ralph the Movie Maker, the one that really put this show on the radar for us, that we really, really needed to find and took a lot of work. We'll get to that in a second. The last episode I want to talk about is Season 8, Episode 11, Hawaiian Club Crashers. The general manager of the Hawaii Yacht Club in Honolulu responds to complaints about non-members at members-only dinner events, which led to some members canceling their memberships. The mystery diners point to bigger problems with two of her wait staff, a waiter named Tony and a waitress named Jordan. They had been sneaking their friends in a members-only event, as well as eating food and drinks meant for guests, and stealing clothing from the club's gift shop. During the confrontation, Tony and Jordan are fired from their jobs. In their exit interview, Tony and Jordan are remorseful for their actions. Their narrator revealed that Tony and Jordan found new employment. The other server and doorman were commended for their loyalty and are training to be assistant managers.
That's nice.
Yeah, their friends were, let's just say, typical immature 20-somethings. They were just ruining the experience for everybody. I believe there was a lot of selfie taking, and one of the rules of the club was you can't use your cell phones or take pictures. And maybe it was a rule for employees only, but yeah, they were breaking that rule by taking pictures with their friends and whatnot. But also, there was like no security at all at this place, because you saw some of these friends sneaking through a back gate. You had some of them, since it's a yacht club, they actually like paddleboarded or took a rode a kayak to the club itself, where there was no gates. They just pulled up their transportation to the shore and entered the club, and nobody noticed. Who wouldn't notice somebody riding a kayak from a quarter mile away or so, maybe not even a quarter mile, let's say 500 feet. Oh, there's somebody who's coming to the shore. Nobody, no management noticed this. I just found that to be, again, a little too good to be true. But yeah, and then they raided the gift shop. They're wearing expensive shirts, for the yacht club shirts. And it was something. It was, again, another badly acted episode, but yeah, these just very rowdy 20-somethings just ruined the experience for a lot of people. And
it's always the 20-somethings. What's up with that?
Kids these days. But the best we saved for last. Greg, do you want the honor of giving the recap?
Yes. Season 8, Episode 2, Poaching Profits. The owner of Cooking with Lenny Smokehouse in Chatsworth, California, fears that someone on his staff is using restaurant supplies to operate a competing catering company called the Delicious Dish Catering Company. Charles Stiles, Mystery Diners, is called in to investigate with the help of his consultant, Brooke Williamson, to help find the culprit. While Brooke reports on a waitress named Grace, who has little tolerance toward the customers during the investigation, it is discovered that the manager Jay and one of the cooks named Carlos was behind the catering project while using the restaurant's recipes. Upon Jay and Carlos claiming it was to help his restaurant out during the confrontation, they are both fired. Jay and Carlos mentioned in their exit interview that they hope Charles Stiles, Mystery Diners, is proud of himself for causing two innocent employees to be fired. The narrator revealed that Jay and Carlos were unsuccessful at starting their own catering company. Grace was also terminated and has since apologized for her behavior. And now we get into the part that made us be like, oh my god, we need to know more about this show.
Wait. Before we get there, the Delicious Dish Catering Company?
I bet they're known for their sweaty balls.
Oh, gee, I did not want to go there.
No!
I just wanted to say, did they steal that from SNL from 20 years ago? I didn't want to hear about sweaty balls. No! But, yeah, it's
it
like...
It was begging to be said, dude.
If it was going to be said, and I'm glad you went there and not me. But, that's yeah, you said sweaty balls. That's what you did. Yeah, the Delicious Dish Catering Company. Oh, my gosh. I bet you it was owned by somebody who worked in public radio. Maybe they talked real quiet like this.
Maybe they did.
It's the Delicious Dish. But, yeah, the big takeaway from this is a phrase that was really focused on by Ralph the Movie Maker, but also it was used in the open for the last four seasons of this show. Three magic words.
Release the drone.
Yes, the three magic words were release the drone. And you wouldn't believe how long it took for me and Greg to find this episode. We were like manically looking for it. Okay, he's got to say it somewhere in those last four seasons. Where's it at? And finally, oh, I'm guessing within about the last month or so, Greg says, I found it. Season 8, episode 2. And lo and behold, there it is. Release the drone. And that's some of the new technology. But it isn't just the releasing of the drone, right, Greg?
No. What happens is the drone malfunctions. And Charles' reaction is like, come on, guys. If that drone goes down, that could compromise the whole thing. And it's going and running around in circles as it's dropping down, and then it crashes. And Charles' reaction is simply,
Dang it. Now, again, this is part of the unbelievability of this show. A drone that's being used, presumably for the first time on a sting, maybe the first time overall. I'm sure they probably played around with it, make sure that it worked. It fails within moments of launching. And then it falls out of the sky and lands like right outside the job that these folks were catering. So it's like, okay, we got to go get the drone before anybody notices us.
Oh my. Seriously?
And then, yeah. And then once it hits the ground,
Dang it.
Amazing.
Yeah, I mean, what are the odds that a drone on its maiden voyage falters? There's a bad battery, or the wiring's bad, or they lose communication because they're too far away. It seems too good to be true. But yeah.
Dang it.
Dang it indeed.
Tell us how you really feel, Charles Stiles Mystery Diners.
I bet you he loved that drone.
Well, the drone was used a couple of times after that. We mentioned the train robbery episode. The drone was used there. The drone was used in an episode where they were watching over a Meals on Wheels type of company and making sure that people were making their appointed rounds and were getting there on time, making sure the food was hot. So the drone did make other appearances in the series. It's just the first time it appeared, it failed.
Or
otherwise. But yeah, if you look up the Ralph the Movie Maker video on Mystery Diners, I think he gives more justice to this clip than we do, but that is like the phrase that pays with Mystery Diners is release the drone and then
dang it.
And we've been talking about these episodes. I mean, we've gone through probably at least a dozen, I'd say, maybe even more than a dozen. You can find the episodes. We mentioned that you can find them. They are available on Food Network's website. If you just search for Mystery Diners, it'll pop up there. Or if you get the Food Network Go app and you search Mystery Diners there, you don't even have to search Mystery Diners. Search Mystery. There's only one show in Food Network's history which has the word mystery in it. And up will pop up the picture of Charles Stiles, Mystery Diners. Click that. Sign in with your cable information. You'll have access to all 11 seasons of shows. It's well worth the time if you have time to kill. This is such a bad show. Yeah, I think we all owe a debt of gratitude to Ralph the Movie Maker, because we would have never seen it if it wasn't for his mentioning of it. But also, one of our good friends, Erskine Thompson, mentioned that he used to watch this on a regular basis, and he said the acting was so horrible on this show. And yes, after seeing however many episodes we've seen, you know, I know Chico's only seen a few, and I've probably seen in the range of about 50 or so, maybe more, and Greg's seen at least that many, I'd assume. The acting is horrible.
I would imagine Greg saw all of them.
Well, Greg actually spent money on this before he found out you can watch it on the Food Network.
Oh, yes! Yes, I should mention, I spent $13.99 on Google Play to watch all 13 episodes from Season 8. I actually spent money to watch this show.
And you could have watched it for free.
Well, the best part of owning a season on Google Play is I don't get indoctrinated with the 7 or 8 ads that play during every commercial break of Mystery Diners on the Food Network app.
And especially since it seems like out of the 7 or 8 ads, 4 of them are the same ad for Allstate. It's Mayhem as a Dog, or Mayhem as the Mother-in-Law. Okay, we get it. We get it. You're trying to sell Allstate insurance on us. Whatever. But yeah, I would definitely search this out. My opinion, and I think Greg shares the same, is from Season 8 on is the best. There's still good episodes from earlier seasons, but the ones that we primarily watched, or at least I did, were seasons like 7 through 11.
Yeah, that's where the best stuff is.
Yeah. And thing is, this doesn't rerun on Food Network anymore. They may not even know they kept these episodes up on their site and their app. So it may be one of those things, enjoy it while you've got it. But yeah.
Or we have a phrase around here, keep circulating the tapes. Or keep the streams going. Well, yeah, keep the streams going because, well, it's available online.
You can watch it, no problem. Let Food Network wonder why, you know, 50 people are watching Mystery Diners when they haven't shown it for, you know, 3 or 4 years.
And you know what? They rebooted Good Eats. They're rebooting Food Network Challenge. They can reboot Mystery Diners. It's not outside the possibility of imagination. I mean, come on, Food Network, let's do this. We need more stilted acting.
How dare you suggest they reboot this thing?
Why not? Why?
I would watch every episode if they rebooted it. I'd have the DVR going. I'd be like, yes, give me all the Charles Stiles Mystery Diners I need.
I really don't think this is high on the list of things that are going to be rebooted at Food Network. You know, maybe they'll give Emeril another show, or you mentioned Good Eats. Maybe they'll do Man vs. Food, since that's sort of shifted from Travel to Cooking Channel. Maybe they'll put it on the main channel, the big channel being Food Network. Who knows? Maybe they'll redo Iron Chef. Gosh knows they've done that a couple of times. I really don't see them rebooting Mystery Diners, for heaven's sakes. Why Stranger not? Things have happened, though.
What can I say except, yeah, it was a thing on TV.
Merry Christmas, everybody!
and guys, if you think we made your Christmas very special. Just wait until we make your New Year's very special.
Oh, jeez.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Next week, we're only doing one episode because, honestly, we think we can probably get about an hour and a half to 2 hours out of that episode. It's a New Year's themed episode. It is not making fun of Dick Clark after his stroke. That's too mean.
That's out of the question.
Yeah, there's no way we'd make fun of that. There's stuff that we could make fun of over the last 5 or 10 years, like Jenny McCarthy kissing like everybody on Dick Clark's New Year's Eve. And
giving him measles.
And exactly, because she's not vaccinated or her kids aren't, exactly. But we have a very special episode next week, which is, it's bad. I mean, I've talked about how I've lasted 5 minutes through some of these episodes. This episode, I purposely jumped towards the end of to see how it ended. And, oh my gosh, I don't want to say I was offended by what happened, but yeah, I landed on a place which sort of put this right at like the top of the list of things we need to cover, because what I landed on was so bad. We'll get to that next week. It's going to be a great show. But yeah, just the one episode next week, and then we'll go back to two episodes starting the week after. As always, please, we're on social media. We're on the internet. We got an email address. You can find everything related to our podcast at www.itwasathingontv.com. You can search for us on iTunes. We're on Stitcher. We're on Google Play. We're on any place that you you can listen to podcasts, it seems. And as always, yeah, please spread the word about us. We'd love for more people to listen to us. And we've been getting some good feedback about some of the shows we've done in the past. Keep it coming. We really appreciate it.
We do.
Well, for Chico and for Greg, I'm Mike. This has been an amazing episode. I know it's been really long. Maybe it went a little longer than you'd expect. So, again, for the guys, thank you very much. Please have a very Merry Christmas. If you don't celebrate that holiday, have a very festive Hanukkah, a great Kwanzaa, or whatever holiday you celebrate. Please have an enjoyable...
And I didn't say this last time, but Happy Life Day.
Oh, jeez. Happy Life Day. Oh.
May you be blessed with a hologram while you get a VR boner.
Oh, God!
Well, I'm not joking. That's what happened with Chewbacca's dad.
We're done. Bye.
Wow! Charles Stiles, Mystery Diners.
Charles Stiles, Mystery Diners. How are you? Charles Stiles, Mystery Diners.
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 Charles Stiles, Mystery Diners.